Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend, and so excited to be back, as always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, the other half of your hosting duo, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, we make it fairly easy that way. And looking ahead to this week, boy, do we ever have a great card and a really interesting one at that. And listen, in the time away, the week away from MMA, we had a great episode out there, an Ultimate Fighter Breakdown Bracket Show. Make sure you check that out. But ultimately, we're watching a lot of basketball, a lot of hockey, a lot of baseball. There's all sorts of sports going on right there. And Matt, when I look at the card that we have coming up this weekend, you have Rozenstruik taking on Sakai in the main event, Colmaine Harris, you have Tybura. But littered through this card, if you've been watching other sports, there's a lot of Eddie Rosarios. There's a lot of Paul Byrons. There's a lot of Joe Harris's. Like, this is kind of a six-man heavy. Yeah, it's a fringe type of card. But hey, I'm always rooting for those underdogs.
It definitely is a fringe type of card, but we do have kind of a refreshing mix of fighters who have already been there and done that versus new up-and-comers. And with the main event and co-main event, it's been a little while since we've had a showcase for the heavyweight division. And yes, the co-main and main, it might not be the most glamorous fights put together in the heavyweight division, but we have two fights that are at least ranked heavyweights. So it is going to be a really nice chance to really get that division moving. So I'm excited for this weekend's card.
Ranked heavyweights, so with the unranked fighters, we have Aliyah Latifi taking on Tanner Bowser. Now, Matt, let's throw it on over to one of my favorite parts of the show. We're going to throw it over to our Fight of the Night screen, as always, presented by Manscaped. Now, Matt, when we're talking fight of the night, the first fight that we have up on the screen, Francisco Trinaldo taking on Muslim Salikov. You might sit there and shake your head because Trinaldo's closer to 43 than he is to, well, 42, 25, whatever age you really want to go with. And for Muslim Salikov, almost 37 years old. But, Matt, these guys can certainly bang, one of which, the King of Kung Fu. I mean, this guy is one of the most accredited strikers you're going to find in MMA. And Masaran Duba, they don't come any tougher than this guy. I love this fight.
Stylistically, this is such a fun fight because Trinaldo was a really fun fighter down at 155 pounds. And then as he's gotten older and a little bit bigger, he's kind of carried power up to 170 all of a sudden. So now you have this kind of uber powerful 42-year-old Masaran Duba taking on Muslim Salikov, who is one of those kind of fighters who, you know, that the ranked fighters don't really want to fight him. He's almost too good to be just given guys off like contender series. He's in this weird limbo, so I could not be more excited for this fight at the welterweight division.
Fireworks at 170 pounds. And when we flip it on over to the second selection, I know this is going to be a fan favorite type of fight. We have a new nickname for Santiago Ponzinibbio, and he's going to be taking on Miguel Baeza, whose nickname I feel kind of uncomfortable saying. But Matt, for Baeza coming out of MMA Masters, this guy is an absolute walking highlight reel. And it's a weird mix here because is it future contender Baeza, Ponzinibbio on a slide? It's really tough to tell what you're going to get in this fight, but you know that it's going to deliver.
I think this fight's going to be absolute fireworks because with Ponzinibbio, yes, he lost to Li Jingliang in his last fight, but you know how exciting a Ponzinibbio fight can be. This absolutely wild Muay Thai practitioner who has absolute thunderous knockout power. And then on the other side, Miguel Baeza, you already got to see sort of his fight of the night caliber performances against Matt Brown. And then for him to go out and beat Takashi Sato, like, those are two really good names to have on your resume. And if you can go out there and beat the former ranked fighter in Ponzinibbio, the sky really is the limit for Miguel Baeza.
Two performance bonuses in his last two fights for Miguel Baeza. We got a great lineup of fights coming up, and I can't wait for it, Matt. And Matt, I can't wait for this weekend's card. I mean, listen, like everybody, I've been cooped up this year. I got into shoes. I made my own blazers, the old Nike idea. I got the FNP on the back. The whole point is so I can wear them at some of these live events. And it's looking like maybe cross your fingers at the end of summer in Canada, we're going to be able to travel a little bit, maybe make it down to the States for some of these shows. But Matt, I really have to shout out Matt Russell at Russ_Customs over on Instagram. Got some Jordan 1 mids done up, and I got the triple whites. I put on the leather laces, but he did such a good job. Canadian flag with Fight Night Picks, the logo, the pop and popcorn, they're really going to pop at those live events. So make sure you check Matt out at Russ_Customs on Instagram. Great guy. We both know him. He's local here from the Fredericton area. Matt, you can also check out fightnightpicks.com for more of the great info. You can also get some of the merch, the Under Armour shirts, the Under Armour hats, all sorts of great stuff over there. We got a great week coming up in combat sports. I can't wait to get back into it. And an awesome card coming up this week. And so Matt, as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Really interesting fight coming up this weekend at 155 pounds. We have the Peruvian Claudio Poyas taking on the Monkey King Jordan Lovett. And Matt, when I went back and did my research for this weekend, this was one of the fights that popped off the page. Because for Claudio Poyas, very young in the game. And the weirdest thing is he came in on the Ultimate Fighter Latin America fighting Martin Bravo in the finale at lightweight. Many, many years ago, back in 2016, now ultimately was not successful. You look at the 5-on-in for this guy, he's 4-1. The one loss is to, well, again, Martin Bravo. And that's the thing. He hasn't been very active in the UFC. Since then, 2 wins. He beats the Muay Thai artist in Felipe Silva. Submits him in a fight where he won a performance bonus. It was one of the biggest comebacks that we've seen in a really long time. Had a super swollen face from a big Silva strike. And then you look at it his last time out, and he beat Marcus Mariano. And listen, Matt, we've talked about it here recently, and credit where credit's due, or whatever the opposite of that is, we've really slighted poor Victor Rodriguez.
We have.
I don't know who the worst UFC fighter is of all time, but Marcus Mariano came into the UFC 6-4. And he left 6-6. And I get it. He was an Anderson Silva protege. But that win, it's great to have. But it was almost 2 years ago. And the other point is, all three judges scored at 30-25 for Poyas. So we didn't really learn a whole lot about the fighter on your left. And if you look at it for Jordan Lovett, well, he had one of the most surprising knockout wins we've seen in a very long time. That slam over old Matt Wyman still holds a lot of water. I mean, yeah. Matt Wyman hasn't been the same since, what, 2013, maybe, when he fought TJ Grant? But it still is a good win for Jordan Lovett. Nevertheless, you look at his win to get into the Contender Series, and that was the one over Luke Flores. 9-1 was the opponent. Before that, maybe not the best record of competition, but overall, you like what you've seen from Jordan Lovett. And both of these guys, I want to say, Matt, very similar stylistically.
They really are. And this is an interesting fight because the UFC normally doesn't kind of cannibalize their prospects against each other. But you do have two fighters who fight in very similar styles, who are very similar ages in the same division. It's just weird matchmaking because normally you look at guys like Claudio Poyas or Jordan Lovett, they're fighting other guys like Matt Wyman, for instance. Guys who they've already kind of been there and done that. They've got a bit of a name. And listen, there might not be a lot of tread left on the tires, but they can still offer these prospects a different look. Jordan Lovett went out there and beat Matt Wyman in probably the most impressive way you possibly can. Like, there's not a harder knockout to watch than a slam knockout. Like, it was tough to watch. Matt Wyman went from smiling 1 second from, like, kind of holding on to a submission to getting knocked on his head the next second. And that's why it's so hard to really judge how good Jordan Lovett is. Because when you look at Twitter, just when you talk around, it feels like there's two very distinct camps of who Jordan Lovett could potentially be. There's people who look at him, they look at the wrestling, they look at his really good cardio in the scramble, and they look at, maybe not Ray Borg per se, but they look at a ceiling similar to Ray Borg, where if this guy can weaponize his pace and use his wrestling in a really effective way, then maybe he could string together some really nice wins, and potentially, I'm not going to say he's going to make his way into the top 15 tomorrow at lightweight, but he could get some nice wins together and potentially get into that top 20, top 25 range. And for Claudio Poyas, it will be interesting. Can he defend the takedowns? And even if he does defend the takedowns, will he want to? Because for me, I feel like this fight's only going to get interesting once they do start to grapple, because neither guy's going to go out there and beat the best of the best in the lightweight division in the striking department.
The weirdest part about this is, and I watched an interview with Jordan Lovett not that long ago, he did one with Karen Bryant, where he kind of talked about the fact that I'm an awkward striker, I'm a southpaw, he's a southpaw, we're both good at grappling. The weirdest thing is, bread and butter takedown is almost the same for both of these guys, and it might seem silly, you look at the way that Lovett kind of picked up Wyman, carried him over to his corner, but for Lovett, a lot of high single legs. For Claudio Poyas, well, it's a high crotch single leg every single time. And listen, that's the other thing. For Poyas, we haven't seen him. It's been long periods of inactivity. This is a guy that made his MMA debut as a teenager. And you look at it, his second to last loss being his first loss. He was fighting a guy that was 36. Well, he was only 18 in that fight. Like, on The Ultimate Fighter, he was 20. So it's crazy to see that. The same thing for Poyas can be said in the fact that training out of Peru, and we threw it up there in the graphic, you can see that he is still at Fight Lab Peru. He's also getting a little bit of reps in for this one at Sanford MMA. So you like the quality of the gym. For his opponent here, Jordan Levitt, I mean, a guy that's been at Syndicate for a really long time, Coach John Wood and the crew there. I mean, really, really good training partners in Levitt's corner. But all of this to say, like, you could cut this one with a knife, how similar these two guys are. And then I would, ever so slightly, I would give the advantage in the striking to Poyas. Now, I have to say, doesn't really have the best head movement that we've seen in his fights. And it's not just the Martin Bravo fight. It was the fight against Silva. The fight against Mariano, he took him down and he absolutely owned him. And I have the numbers here, Matt, and I really need to talk about them. Because, again, 330-25s, it's not often that you see that, but 101-5 were the total strikes, and he had 13 minutes and 20 seconds of control time in that fight. So you know that both these guys are quite good. For Jordan Levitt with the striking, again, rangy southpaw, he throws maybe the more unorthodox techniques. The one thing I don't totally love is that he does the thing, and we talk about this, it's a very, very big defensive move. When he goes in and gets close to an opponent, he brings his right leg up almost to defend like the Anthony Smith off the back on the cage. Don't necessarily love that, but again, stylistically, very, very close. And for me, when I look at this fight, I see the odds. I just kind of scratch my head.
I see why you scratch your head, but there is the flip side. You could look at this fight kind of like, and I know people are sick and tired of me bringing this up, Carlos Suarez and Tatiana Suarez. If you have two people who, yes, stylistically they are similar, but one of the two is the slightly better wrestler, if it's just going to be a wrestling match between these two, then the better wrestler is probably going to win out. And with Jordan Levitt, I do see the slightly more refined wrestler out of these two, and that's why I do have to side with Jordan Levitt. Is he the worst striker out of the two? I would agree with you that, yes, his striking isn't as refined as Poirier is, but I really don't think it's going to cost him in this fight. Let's say after this they make him fight, like, goodness, I don't know, Benil Dariush or just someone wicked, like, then those holes are really gonna start to show themselves. I just don't think those holes will start to reveal themselves just yet. And for Levitt, here's the weird thing, because we both kind of talked about it, is he UFC ready? Maybe. Or could he really be that next level prospect? Like, this is a really important fight for both guys, because again, the winner of this is going to be the prospect at 155. Yes, there's a lot of prospects at 155, but the winner of this fight's really going to distinguish themselves as the cream the crop.
And I mean, you have a look at those odds that I teased. Levitt open a minus 300 favorite. He's a minus 204 right now. For Poyas, open a plus 250. He's a plus 166. And if we have a look at Tapology, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. Holy smokes. Wow. 1,330 total votes, 91% Levitt. You've got 61% by submission, 9% have Claudio Poyas to win. And I'm of the 9%. I've got Claudio Poyas in this fight as the underdog. I absolutely love the striking. Again, if you can refine a little bit of the takedowns, anything I've seen in terms of training footage, getting ready for this one in the time away has been with the striking, but we know exactly what his ground game is. I like Poyas in this fight. But again, I'm in agreement with you here. It was kind of like the Font Garbrandt type of fight. Levitt, if he's a little bit better of a wrestler, you're probably going to see that early on. And would I be surprised that Levitt wins this fight? No. To me, I'm surprised by the votes. I'm surprised by the odds. I see this one as a very, very close fight. And with that, I'll side with the underdog.
I do see this as a close fight, and maybe the odds are a little bit further apart than I would personally like, but I do have to side with Jordan Levitt at the end of the day for the reason that I brought up. I just think he is the better wrestler, and if this match is primarily going to be a grappling battle between the two, for me, it's going to be hard to pick against Jordan Levitt, but I do think this is a really interesting fight at lightweight between two potentially really high-level prospects.
Matt, absolutely love the fight. We have the Ultimate Fighter, Latin America 3. He was on Team Liddell, wow. Claudio Poyas, and I've got him, and Matt, you have the man himself, the Monkey King, Jordan Levitt. Love the fight. Make sure you check out the rest of the card. Main event, holy smokes, Augusto Sakai taking on Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Two big-time featherweight prospects fighting against each other this weekend. We have the Moroccan Devil, Yusuf Salal, taking on the sniper, Sean Woodson. And I'm surprised that we're getting this fight, but at the same time, I'm not. Because for Sean Woodson, he had a short-notice opponent change. He had a really good fight booked, and all of a sudden, Julian Arosa steps in. Now, Juicy J, maybe not the best UFC fighter. Maybe it's a guy that lost handily to Artem Lobov in The Ultimate Fighter. But ultimately, you know exactly what you're going to get with Julian Arosa. He is normally a tough customer, gives one to take one. And if you go back and watch that fight against Woodson, Well, Woodson pieces him up in the first round. He switches stances, and Sean Woodson's one of those guys. He's not really coming out of the biggest gym in Wolves' then training center, just outside of St. Louis, Missouri. He also has trained at Glory MMA and Fitness. You saw James Krause in his corner for that last fight. You can't blame James, but if you do watch that first one, all kinds of feints. And he's like an old-timey boxer. He kind of throws, whips his weird little feints and combinations in there. But this is a guy that when you're talking about an amateur background, it's insane. What was it? 46-3 his amateur boxing record. He had a bad car accident, couldn't turn pro as a boxer. So he picked up MMA. And you look at it. Going into that fight, he was 7-0, one of the hottest prospects in the division, a minus 500 favorite to boot. Did we both have Woodson?
Yes.
Yeah, we did previewing that fight, 100%. First round, Woodson looked good. Second round, it got close. Arosa kind of closed the distance, made it a little bit of a dirty fight. He really did eat some big shots. And then in the third round, it got weird. And that submission attempt, a little strange, but a big time Darius for Julian Arosa and a performance of the night bonus. So for Woodson, the star kind of fell a little bit. It really did. And then if you look at it for Yusuf Zalal, well, the guy came in on a heater. You look at him with LFA, he loses two in a row. Then he goes on a streak. He beats Austin Lingo in his UFC debut, and we're off to the races. But then you look at the losses. I mean, you lose to Ilya Topuria. I can't really fault him for that. You lose to Sungwoo Choi. Now, I remember previewing that fight, and I thought that I gave Choi his flowers, and I was on the fence about the pick, to be totally honest with you. And ultimately, Choi gonna Choi, and he looked absolutely amazing in that fight. And for Zalal, couldn't really get it going. Last thing for me, Matt, in the interview that JHK has here on the channel, make sure you check it out, but it is a great one. Yusuf Zalal kind of talked about the fact that he had to kind of get his mental game level, and he was going into these fights thinking, hey, I'm going to have fun, I'm going to be putting on a performance, everybody wants to see this. Now it's kill or be killed. And that's an interesting spot for Zalal to be in here.
It really is. And this is a super important fight for both athletes. Because you had mentioned, this is an exciting fight between two exciting prospects. But these are exciting prospects in the way that, like, Pascal Siakam and Julius Randle are most improved. They're good, but then you get to the playoffs, and then your weaknesses really start to show. And then guys like Randle, you have to ask them to do a lot of things that they're not used to doing. And then you see, they just can't really hold the load. Same thing with Siakam. Woodson and Zalal, I would say they're better than their last performances would dictate, but I would say that they are two fighters on extremely thin ice, because for Woodson, yes, he's only coming off one loss, but I think that was a bad loss, because here's the thing. We don't talk about guys losing a fight where they were a minus 500 all that often. Most of the time, they won via spectacular fashion, or Maria Agapova lost to Shayna Dawson, and we just bring it up as a goof every now and then. Like, it doesn't happen all that often. And my thing with Sean Woodson is, and I'm going to have to quote Teddy Atlas for this, Sean Woodson is one of those fighters who, when the going gets tough, it's not that he can't get it back. It's just when fights start to get ugly, and once he does start to tire, He just stops doing a lot of the things that you like from Sean Woodson. You talk about the fact that he switches stances. He is a really rangy striker. But when the fight starts to get ugly, you can close the distance on him. He's not a guy who will stay really disciplined to his game plan, who realizes, okay, I might be really tired, but as long as I can stick to my game plan, I can still win this fight. If you make the fight ugly, you can start to get to Sean Woodson, and that really is going to be the key for Yusuf Zalal. Is Zalal going to get hit at range? Without a doubt. I'm assuming he's going to walk into a bunch of straight shots from southpaw and from the orthodox position. But if Zalal can stay disciplined, stay within himself, and like you said, be on his mental game to realize that, okay, I'm going to get hit in this fight, but if I can walk through those punches, or at least have good enough head movement to get through the punches, close the distance, force some grappling exchanges, or at least make this an MMA fight and not just a striking fight at the range, I think Yusuf Zalal can have a ton of success.
Well, when I watch Sean Woodson fight, and they're most likely have him out of the orthodox stance, I kind of look at him like the Pat Vendetti of MMA. And that's a reference that, hey, A's fans and occasional Blue Jays fans, you might get it, but the guy's really ambidextrous. He can throw the same shot from either stance.
Not Mickey Mantle.
But the weird thing is, through his one fight on Contender Series and his two nods out in the UFC, and again, he beat Kyle Bochniak and he lost to Julian Arosa, less than 10% of his strikes have been kicks. And you look at his legs, and you make fun of me, and you make fun of Matt, but they look like candlesticks. And
they
listen,
can't see our legs.
We're in
you
the same boat. Exactly. But the guy's 6'2.5 at 145 pounds. Not really the biggest recipe for success. I mean, did Will Chope have success? For a bit. Did Cole Miller have success? Kinda.
Limited.
But when you're taking on guys like a Yusuf Zalal, who might throw in a few more kicks, I mean, Arosa did it, and listen, Sean Woodson doesn't really check them, and he gets to a point where if you throw enough kicks, He just kind of leaves that leg up there. Now, for a guy that is as ambidextrous as a Sean Woodson, he can still fire off the jab. He can still whip the uppercut in there. He can still throw some hooks, but you can't get as much power as you could earlier on in the fight. And that's the thing that I worry about a little bit. Again, with Zalal, what's the story? Well, he's really well-rounded. He's a very good wrestler. He can chain things together. Just in the last two fights, Sungmoo Choi was a little bit better at everything. And for Ilia Topuria, I mean, one of the best grapplers we have in this division. I mean, yeah, you got to prove it to me, but holy smokes, that was the performance that we needed. So in this fight, it is really tricky. Again, Factory X against Wolves Den slash Glory. And the other thing for Sean Woodson, you talked about it with cardio. This is a guy that has such the extensive amateur boxing record. He won Golden Gloves at light heavyweight.
That's wild.
And now we're at 145 pounds, so it is a tricky one. When I looked at the odds, it really surprised me. Woodson opened a minus 115 slight favorite. He's now minus 188. You look at it for Zalal, opened a minus 105. He's now at a plus 155. So the line switched quite a bit for Woodson. 1,346 total Tapology votes, 60% Woodson, 40% Zalal. Again, the fans that have Zalal to win, 77% by decision. For Woodson, 85% by decision. So mostly everybody's thinking this one's going to go the distance. Who does it really favor then?
I might be making a massive mistake right now, but I really do think Yusuf Zalal is going to get back to his winning ways. And for these reasons, Sean Woodson, like we said, he is a good fighter at range, but when he does get tired, it's not like he throws less punches. He just kind of stops throwing completely. And that's the big problem with Sean Woodson. Like, with Yusuf Zalal, when he gets tired, he still does the same things. He just lacks a bit of explosiveness on the end of his techniques. With Sean Woodson, he falls off a cliff with his cardio to the point where he just won't really throw that much in return. To where, if this fight is in the third round, and let's say this is a grueling back and forth fight where Woodson is catching Zalal on the way in, but Zalal's making him pay for it, then I don't think Sean Woodson's going to be able to keep that output and that uptick throughout that third round. I think he is going to get tired, and I think throughout this fight, Zalal will be the one picking up steam. And here's the thing, I'm not even in love with Yusuf Zalal's gas tank. I just think it's better than Sean Woodson's, and I do think that's what this fight's going to come down to.
Yeah, I mean, this one to me, pot and popcorn. Enjoy two prospects going at it, two guys with really good futures. Again, if Zalal loses another one, yeah, it's tricky to come back from 10-5, but the guy's only 24, almost 25, so it's not the end of the road, but it is a really tricky one. For Woodson, we've seen it, takedown defense, it's been good so far, but he's only had to defend a few different takedowns. From Julian Arosa, they were fairly weak at that, so I do have a tricky time with this fight, but again, if Woodson's able to pop things off from range early and really kind of discourage the law from the entries, I got Sean Woodson in this one. Now, it is a really tricky fight. Again, I don't necessarily love the odds, especially where they're at right now. But let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight. Are you going with Missouri's own Sean Woodson as I am? Or are you going to go with the Moroccan Devil with Yusuf Zalal? Matt has him. I can't wait for this fight. We've got a great card coming up. Tabora Harris in the co-main event. You get Sakai taking on Rosenstrike in the main event. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. One of my favorite fights coming up this weekend at Flyweight, we have Marina Moroz taking on Manon Fiorot. And Matt, for Frances Fiorot, holy smokes, did she look great in her UFC debut not that long ago, just 4 months ago, taking on Victoria Leonardo. And holy smokes, I mean, her 2020 entering 2021, getting wins with UAE Warriors, winning the UFC championship even before that, coming in full head of steam and then finishing Leonardo, a name that fans knew and recognized from Invicta, from Dana White's Contender Series. Fiorot looked amazing. And Matt, we talked a lot about Manon Fiorot before that fight, really getting in depth with the background. So let's throw it back to that, and then we'll really get into the nuts and bolts of this fight coming up against the Iron Lady from Ukraine, Marina Moroz. If you look at Manon Fiorot, this is a fighter that I haven't been hyped about a French fighter like this since, what?
Tom Duquesnoy?
Cyril Gane, maybe? Kid. I don't know. Alain Badeau? But Manon Fiorot has really been making moves, whether it was with the IMMAF championships back in 2017. She won them at Bantamweight. You look at her pro debut. She took on Leah McCourt in Cage Warriors and lost a split decision. First round definitely went her way. The last two rounds probably went Leah McCourt's way. And she's really been a superstar over with Bellator on commentary and even in her fights. So for Manon Fiorot, she goes from that to EFC. And they call it The Fighter. It's like The Ultimate Fighter, but The Fighter Season 2. She goes there, wins that, beats the champion, and then she's queen of EFC. So then what does she do? She goes and fights with UAE Warriors. And I watched every fight, because you gotta. but she had three fights in 2020, finished all three. And if you look at the level of competition, it's so-so. The first fight against Quebec's Corinne Laframboise was probably the toughest test because if you look at it, she totally outstrikes Laframboise. I don't know if I've ever seen a nose injury that bad. She looked like Arlovsky at the end of the second into the third. But she continues to pressure. She continues to try and land power shots. She was a champion jiu-jitsu fighter. And again, record's a little salty, but she is a good fighter. If you go back and watch that one, it was halfway competitive. The commentary with UAE Warriors, if you watch all three of those fights, incredibly one-sided for Manon Fiorot, so maybe just hit mute on that one. But she picks up a huge win there, ends it at the end of the third round. TKO win there. She beats Naomi Tataroglu, and that one wasn't really close at all. Tataroglu just kind of chased her around. And then if you look at her last win to win the belt, the flyweight belt that they created, she beat 6-1 Gabriela Campo. Again, Campo wasn't really on that level. It wasn't really a close fight whatsoever. Kind of looked like, you know, the writing was on the wall probably 30 seconds before she finished it. But the big takeaway from Manon Fiorot is the fact that she has a kickboxing background, and you can see it in every single one of her fights. Her karate and her kickboxing are her championship-type level thing that she possesses. The two things with that, throws a crazy kick to the body. She really tries to establish distance with that push kick to the body. She'll kick to the legs, kick to the body. She's good on her back foot. And she is, and I'm going to cue up the clip, she is the Maria Sharapova of MMA. All right, Matt, so that gives you a little bit of a backstory to Manon Fiorot, and she does typically use about the same attack in every fight. It's just nobody can really solve it. Now, Matt, Marina Moroz is one of those fighters that is really, really tricky, and you can really attest to this because in her UFC debut, she submitted Joanne Calderwood, and she's really gone on to have an interesting career, 5-3 so far in the UFC, still young as well, under 30 years old, representing Ukraine. I can't wait for this one. This is a weird fight. Let's just call it what it is. Because it is. Because Marina Moroz, you bring up the Calderwood performance. It was a weird performance because Moroz, she's kind of like a surface level Nate Diaz. You look at her numbers and yeah, she throws an incredible amount of volume. Yes, her jiu-jitsu is all right. Does she have any wrestling though? Not really. Does she have any power in her hands? Well, not at all. And it's just really weird because we're talking about a Marina Moroz fight. You also have to talk about how she games the system because a lot of the times in her fight, she won't land any significant strikes. And I mean in the bare minimum where she will throw over 200 strikes and land about 20 of them. This is the type of fighter that we're talking about in Moroz. And it's weird because, yeah, she's throwing a lot, but if you're only landing at about a 10 to 15% clip, does it really matter? And if none of your punches are doing anything, should you really win the decision that way? Because this is how I look at this fight. Manon Fiorot is going to walk forward a lot. And she's going to continue to walk forward throughout this fight. Because I don't think she's going to respect the power Marina Moroz has. And if she does have respect for Marina Moroz's power, then maybe Moroz can and volume her way to a 30-27. But my issue is that I feel like the book's just out on Moroz. You don't have to respect her power on the feet whatsoever. You could eat 1-2s from her all day long. She could hit you with 15 punches a second for all I care, and she is not going to TKO anybody. And with Manon Fiorot, you talk about it. She's got that great left straight. She's got the great kicks. I just think she's the much more polished and the much more deadly striker. I guess the much more effective striker, I should say. So at the end of the day, unless Fiorot slips and Moroz somehow gets on her back, unless something weird happens, I don't know how Fiorot loses this fight. I really don't. Oh boy, the guy that was always behind Jacare Souza. I have a hard time with this one. And I'll tell you why. Because
what?
For
Jacare, what does that have to
and mean? Andrea Muniz. I mean, Jacare was never going to get submitted. But with Manon Fiorot, I look at this fight and we've seen it from her in the past. Takedown defense is half decent. And the other thing, she's willing to play in the ground against good fighters on the ground. You might look at it, Corinne Laframboise, the record's not all that great, but very credentialed in terms of jiu-jitsu, and Manon Fiorot made it look easy. So in a fight like this, you look at it for Moroz, the only losses, Valerie Letourneau, Carla Sparza, Angela Hill. Both, all very good fighters. The wins in her last two, Sabina Mazzau, and then Maeda Bueno Silva, who again, yeah, did she have a draw against one tough out Montana De La Rosa? Yeah, but it was after a really long layoff. So I'll be interested to see what we do get out of a fight like this because for Moroz, She does throw at a high volume, but again, 25% is actually her striking percentage, and that's not great.
Kwame Brown shot a better percentage, and the only reason people know who he is because he was bad at the sport that he did. So that tells you the kind of numbers Rose is putting up. Like, normally when we bring you their significant strike numbers, it's because they're so high or it's so impressive that, like, wow, we really need to tell you about the numbers. If you're only landing one for every four strikes that you're throwing, you're landing on air so much. Like, this is my point with Rose. Is she going to game the system, and are the judges going to look at her incredible amount of strikes thrown and really weigh that more than the strikes landed for a field goal? Because that's what happens in a Moreau's fight. I guarantee you she's going to throw more strikes, and she might even land more strikes if we're being honest. But when you look at who's going to land the more effective strikes, or who's going to be doing the more damaging work, at the end of the day, it has to be field goal.
Yeah, I mean, normally I would end up going with experience over a fighter like field goal, but I look at it, the extensive striking background, and the fact that Fiorot opened a minus 140 favorite. She's now minus 164. If you have a look at Moroz's line, she opened a plus 120. She's plus 135 underdog. And over on Tapology, 1,327 total votes, 70% Fiorot, 62% by decision, 33% by knockout. For the 30% that I'm Moroz, 86% have her to win by decision. So in this one, I'm Manon Fiorot. But again, this is one of those fights where if I woke up the next morning and Marina Moroz won a split decision, I wouldn't be overly surprised. I'm going with Frances Manon Fiorot to get the win. You are as well.
Much like Andre Drummond, I just don't really like Marina Moroz's game. It's just there's something about it. I don't like the fact that she goes out there and lands at such a low clip. I agree 100% with you. I like Fiorot quite a bit in this
fight. Both of us going with Frances Manon Fiorot to get the win. Can't wait for this card. Big time fights in the main. A co-main, Harris Tybura. You get Sakai taking on Rosenstrike. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at, well, is it welterweight? Is it lightweight? We've got Alain Patrick taking on Mason Jones. And for the Dragon, Mason Jones, representing Wales, former Cage Warriors double champ, came over to the UFC with much fanfare and absolutely threw down in a fight of the night with Mike Davis. I mean, man, that was a great fight. And for Mason Jones, it's his first pro loss, but I don't think he really lost a lot of stock. I mean, Mike Davis is an incredible boxer, and so is Mason Jones. They went at it for three rounds. What more could you ask for? And the reason why I really scratch my head is the fact that Alain Patrick, if you have a look at his total line, he's never fought at welterweight in his career. He's always been a lightweight. So I went over to his Instagram, and 2 days ago, he posted a video where he's getting ready for this. He's in Florida. He's stepping onto the scale. He weighed in at 76.3 kilos or roughly 168 pounds. So my question is, Tapology's got it at welterweight. UFC Stats has it at welterweight. UFC has it at lightweight. It's all over the map. And the reason why I bring this up is the fact that for Mason Jones, a much younger fighter coming in here, just turned 26. For Alain Patrick, he's just a shade under 38. For Jones, he's been a double champ, 55-70. For Patrick, he's spent his whole career 55. So listen, if it's at 155 pounds, Alain Patrick is going to cut, what, 13 pounds, roughly, to make it to fight day. Okay, that's fine. That's not totally out of the question. But it's just odd to see this kind of air of uncertainty before a fight like this.
Okay, so I'm not going to bring up the weight just yet. Because if I talk about the weight, I'm just going to give away what my pick is. So let's talk about the X's and O's really quick before we get into that. Mason Jones, this is a really interesting fight, because here's the thing. We talked a little bit before we started filming how there are a lot of fighters on this card who are coming off of losses looking to rebound, but these fighters are coming off very different kinds of losses, where Mason Jones, yeah, he lost his last fight, but I still feel like he's on the uptick. You know, I don't look at him and, oh, Mason Jones' best days are behind him. I look at him and, oh, he fought another really high-level prospect in his last fight, and it was a great fight. And honestly, that was one of those fights where at the end of it, if it was scored 30-27 either way, you could have understood the scorecard.
And the really interesting thing about that fight too, and we gotta stop saying that, but for Mason Jones, he was training solely out of Wales for that camp, but we'd seen it in the past, even with Cage Warriors, had the presence of mind, being such a young fighter with such a big cap in terms of his talent, that he went over to train at Team Alpha Male. For this camp, he's training out of Team Alpha Male for the most part. So you like to see that, the quality of partners. I mean, the Darren Elkins, the Uriah Favors.
I'm going to push back on that. I saw that he was training with Team Alpha Male. I don't really love that. They don't have any people his size there. That's my problem. It does matter. Like, you need training partners who are around your size who are at that caliber. Like, this is my big problem. If you weigh 135 pounds, it's great. Chad Mendes is probably going to come in every now and then. You've got Cody Garbrandt, Uriah Favors, a wealth of knowledge. Like, these are guys around your size who can really really help you and really show you through the practice. It's a really good thing to have. It's kind of like when Firas Sahabi was in his prime with GSP. It was a younger guy who could still show all the techniques, and him and GSP were around the same size. Mason Jones has nobody around his size to really help him at that gym. I do understand that there are a lot of other UFC levels of competition and talent there. I just don't really know if it was the right gym per se. I still think this is Mason Jones' fight to lose, and especially if it is at welterweight, because this is what I mean. If we're going to bring up the weights, and especially if Alon Patrick only weighs 170 pounds right now, Mason Jones is going to have to cut weight to make 170. I can tell you that right now. He is a massive 155-pounder. He has a very similar build to, think Drew Dober, kind of. Like, similar build to a Drew Dober and less of, like, a Yancy Medeiros, for instance. And my problem with Alon Patrick is that he is kind of built in that Alex Oliveira, Yancy Medeiros build where, yes, they're longer, yes, they're rangier, but him fighting up at 170 pounds isn't going to give him any advantage that he wouldn't have at 155 pounds. If this fight is at 170 pounds, Mason Jones wins it 100 times out of 100. Okay, I shouldn't be that 100% certain because I don't have the best track record with it, but I'm much more confident about Mason Jones's chances at 170 pounds. At 155 pounds, I still think Mason Jones's constant pressure and his boxing are going to make this fight an ugly fight, and he's going to be able to get on the inside of the range of Alon Patrick and make it a very similar fight to what Scott Holtzman was able to do to Patrick, because really, Scott Holtzman's kind of like a more bare bones version of what Mason Jones is.
Yeah, and that's it. And for me with Mason Jones, it worked out for him with Cage Warriors to continue the role at Team Alpha Male because we saw how good of a boxer he was, and if you can incorporate just a little bit of the game, it's going to work out in spades for you. So for Jones, coming into a fight like this, Alon Patrick, great at jiu-jitsu, but then you have a look at the way that he looked in his Holtzman fight, and then in the fight against Bobby Green, Bobby Green out-wrestled him and dominated him on the ground.
And going into the Holtzman fight, like, Patrick was a pretty high-level prospect. Like, I know he was a little bit older, but he was in that, like, Hani Barcelos area where it's like, yeah, you're a little bit older than 30, but, like, no one really wants to fight you. Like, there was a little bit of hype behind this guy. This is my problem, though. Scott Holtzman's an all-right fighter, don't get me wrong, but, like, Scott Holtzman's a very basic version of what a wrestle boxer can be in MMA, and then you look at Mason Jones, he's a much younger, much more heavy-handed, and I'd say much more developed version of what Scott Holtzman even is, and he's only, what, 24 years old? So, in Mason Jones, at 155 pounds, I really like him to win this fight, at 155 pounds, I really like Mason Jones, and if this fight is at 170, I really like him to win.
I love Patrick. Open a plus 210 underdog. He's now at a plus 237. If we look at it for Mason Jones, open a minus 250. He's a minus 302. And if we look over on Topology, not much of a surprise. 1,340 total votes. 87% Jones, 60% by knockout. Again, to me, this all comes down on, well, what weight class it actually going to be at. We'll have the opportunity to look back at that on Question Mark Kick Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims. But Matt, for me, I got to go with the Dragon representing Wales from Abertillery. I'm going with Mason Jones in this fight. For Alon Patrick, again, I like it. You're out of, what is it, Gracie Baja, Orlando, splitting time there, as well as with Sanford, but it's just tricky late in his career. Based on the last two performances we've seen, this isn't really the guy that fought Demir Hadzovic, and that win 3 years and 3 months ago. And that's going to be a trend on this card. We have quite a few fighters who haven't won in 2-3 years. They're up there in age. Can they turn back the clock? It's tough for me to go with the guy that hasn't looked good in his last number of fights, where Mason Jones loses one, but still gains stock. So I get Jones.
No, I couldn't agree more. Mason Jones in his last performance, like, Mike Davis would have beat Alon Patrick too, you know? Like, if you lose to a guy like Mike Davis, especially the way that he did, he ate some bombs from Mike Davis, and he ate massive shots, and he had a really good gas tank in that fight too. Yes, he got tired as it went on, but both guys did. They had a crazy level of output. So I do like Mason Jones quite a bit, especially at 170, but I still like him even if this fight isn't lightweight.
Matt, both of us going with Mason Jones to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. Two big heavyweight fights up at the top. You've got Augusto Sakai taking on Rozenstruik in the co-main event, Tybura and Walt Harris. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. My personal favorite fight on the card at 170 pounds. We have Masaran Duba, Francisco Trinaldo taking on the King of Kung Fu, Muslim Salikov. Now, Matt, they had a little bit of an appendage of a tournament at the 2008 Beijing Olympics in Wushu Sanda. And my guy, Muslim Salikov, won gold. Kind of crazy. This guy has one of the strangest, most accomplished backgrounds in striking that you've either A, heard of and bought a ton of stock into, or B, I'm the first one telling you. And if so, hi, congrats. I'm glad that you found us here. As always, one half your host, Neil Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram At Craig Allen FMP, Matt at Matt Allen FMP on the respective socials. For Muslim Salikov, his kickboxing record, they have this one over on Wikipedia. You take it with a grain of salt. You don't cite it as a source. But 185-13-1. The Wushu Sanda background you know and love. He is also a BJJ blue belt. Not as highly accredited as Francisco Trinaldo on the ground, but he can get himself out of some sticky situations. And if you look at it from Muslim Salikov, he got himself into the UFC with one of the craziest knockouts over a legend in Melvin Gallard. And then you look at it, loses to Alex Garcia in his debut, the Dominican Nightmare, crazy, crazy grappler, knocks out Ricky Rainey, knocks out Nordin Taleb, beats Laureano Starpoli by decision, who's also on this card, and beat Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos in his last fight. Now, Matt, you can argue that Eliseu won that fight if you go to MMA decisions.
It's a terrible fight.
Five panelists had it 30-27, Zaleski dos Santos. Nine had it 29-28, Zaleski. And two had it 29-28 for Salikov. It only took two real judges to score it that way, and that's how the fight went.
Remember how excited we were for that fight, though? Like, Zaleski dos Santos versus Muslim Salikov, how could that fight be boring is what we were saying. The fight wasn't great. And that's the weird thing about Muslim Salikov versus Francisco Trinaldo. We have it as a fight of the night. We're very excited for this fight. There is a chance, though, that this fight is an absolute dud between these two guys. Let's just get that out of the way right now. Because for as good as Muslim Salikov is, and yes, we enjoy, you know, the kung fu background. We enjoy the crazy kicks and all that.
Wushu Sanda.
Wushu Sanda. But sometimes he will just kind of stand around and stare in the mirror with his opponent. With a guy like Francisco Trinaldo, who, you know, the word crafty gets thrown around a lot, but for a guy to be 42 years old and to not really be ever, like, one of those main event caliber fighters, like, there's one thing to be 42, like Andre Arlovsky, for instance, former champ, he's main evented, he'll go on a streak every now and then. Like, I can understand why he's in the UFC at 42. Francisco Trinaldo's won three fights in a row at the age of 42. That's not a sentence I ever thought I would be saying in one of these videos. And the fact that he now has the chance to go up against one of those borderline ranked fighters at welterweight really means something for the career resurgence of Francisco Trinaldo. And I do feel like he's one of those fighters who, yes, it was getting a little stale down at 155. I feel like the weight cut was definitely getting hard on him as he was getting older. He has reinvented himself to a certain degree at 170 pounds.
Well, that's a weird thing, because if you look at it for Trinaldo, he's 4-1 in his last five. I would make a strong argument he's won five fights in a row. I had him to beat Alexander Hernandez. Again, same thing could be said for Salikov in his last fight, so arguments for argument's sake. But if you look at it for Trinaldo, his last time out, he missed weight big time. He weighed 160.5. We've got it up there on the graphic. He took on Jai Herbert, who was making his UFC debut, coming over from Cage Warriors. I love me some Jai Herbert, a guy who trains with a fighter that we're going to see later on in this card, in Tom Breeze, but that's neither here nor there. For Masaran Duba, well, the first couple rounds were what they were, and then in the third, Herb Dean, what are we doing, Herb? Like, do we have to watch Jai just kind of sit there? And then Trinaldo was like, hey, like, let's show him some mercy. I don't need to hit him again. It was a terrible knockout, but a good win, but a terrible knockout. So Trinaldo making the move now up to 170. I'll be interested to see how big he is, because to me, and it's not a Brazilian comparison for that, but Gleison Tibau at 170, and then Francisco Trinaldo at 170. And I say it too, because guys that have trained in American Top Team, that's where you have Trinaldo out of now. You see him in the camp, but I mean, Trinaldo, crafty vet. He does really good work up against the cage and the clinch. He's good on the ground. He's good on the feet. He's a very well-rounded fighter.
He is, and I actually think Trinaldo is going to give Salikov problems in the boxing range. Because the weird thing about Trinaldo is, yeah, he's 42. Yeah, he's old. He still is pretty fast. Like, he's got really good hand speed, and he throws weird kicks too, especially off the front leg. He's got weird, like, crescent kicks and weird axe kicks that he likes to throw. Rarely lands them, but it is just a different look that he will give his opponent. And with someone like Salikov, maybe that will entice Salikov to start throwing some of his own odd kicks, and maybe that could turn this fight into a very fun version of what it could be. But with Trinaldo, I don't think he's getting enough credit in this fight. And listen, I'm probably not going to predict him to win, if we are being honest, but I do think that there are different ranges that Trinaldo's really going to give Salikov trouble in. I do think that if Trinaldo can get Salikov moving backwards, especially using his inside leg kicks, and using some of those boxing combinations, it's not like Trinaldo's like Anderson Silva. He can't box you up by throwing like 14 punch combinations, but he can back you up with some of his power. If Salikov finds himself just reacting to what Trinaldo's throwing at him, then he's going to find himself in a very bad position. But if we do see the, I'm going to say the 2 years ago Salikov, the more aggressive version, the guy who wasn't afraid to move forward, wasn't afraid to throw his kicks really in rapid succession, because that's the weird thing about Salikov. We talk about how some guys, they set up their kicks with their hands. Salikov will throw like a spinning back kick into a leg kick into a head kick. Like, he will mix his kicks up in a really unique way, and I think that's what makes this fight so much fun.
We'll have to see what happens in this one. In terms of the odds, Muslim Salikov over to minus 250 favorite. He's just kind of gained a little bit. Minus 257 for Trinaldo, open a plus 190, he's plus 209. If we have a look at Tapology, Matt, I'm somewhat surprised. 1,019 total votes, 87% Salikov, 72% have him to win by decision for the 13% that have Trinaldo, 65% by decision. These guys have finished fights in the past. I love this matchup, and it is tricky. But for me, I got to go with the striking background of Muslim Salikov. But you're right. I can see a world where Trinaldo wins. I have it as a very close fight, but I do have Salikov here.
Ultimately, I do have to agree. It's weird that Melvin Gallard is, like, multiple guys taking to get into the UFC. Adesanya knocked him out with, like, a question mark kick. Salikov knocked him out. Just, it's weird that Melvin Gallard holds that key to the UFC. But no, I do agree. I think Salikov should be able to use his kicks a lot in this fight, and he should be the bigger fighter. Although Trinaldo, I don't think, will be a small welterweight. I still think Salikov, with his striking background and the size advantage, I do think he should win.
Absolutely. Love the fight. It's one of my favorite fights this weekend. We both have Russia's Muslim Salikov to get the win. And holy smokes, two big heavyweight fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss them. So keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Weirdest fight that we have straight up this weekend. Our first of three heavyweight fights. These guys unranked. We have the Bulldozer Tanner Bozer representing our glorious nation of Canada, taking on Sweden's Ilir Latifi. He is the sledgehammer, but he hasn't been hammering anything lately. He's 0-3 in his last three, 2-3 in his last five. We're going to have fun with it. And his last win was a submission win over Ovince St. Preux about 3 years ago. Since then, losing to Corey Anderson, Volkan Oezdemir, Derek Lewis. Now I got to talk about that Derek Lewis fight because, listen, Ilir Latifi thinks it's a robbery. So I went through and I watched it again. Yeah, Alir, you won the second round. For sure, Alir Latifi won the second round. I went on MMA Decisions. 12 of the members had it 29-28 Lewis. One had it 29-28 Latifi. That's where it's weird, because they bring him up to heavyweight for Alir Latifi. I'm late in my career. I'm almost 38 years old. My first pro fight was against Blagoy Ivanov, and the ring collapsed. And now we're here. So they made him fight future title challenger Derek Lewis, two-time title challenger, and you lose 29-28. So you went to the top to come in. Now you're going to fight unranked Tanner Bozer. For Tanner Bozer, to his credit, didn't look great against Andrei Arlovski. It was a good fight. And originally I had a 29-28 Bozer, and on a second and third rewatch, I did score it for Arlovski, but albeit a close fight. He finishes Rafael Pessoa. He finishes Felipe Lins. He loses to Ciryl Gane. He beats Daniel Spitz. Now, Daddy Longleg Spitz, we don't really hear about him all that often in the UFC, losing to Ciryl Gane in a back-and-forth fight. It was a good fight, back-and-forth striking battle. You learn a little bit about both fighters. You beat Lins, you beat Pessoa, who's, I mean, USADA knocking down that door.
That's true.
And then you lose to Arlovski in a fight where Bozer landed more, but Arlovski landed the more, I would say, qualitative shots rather than quantitative. So you have Bozer the striker, you have Latifi, the takedown machine. It's an interesting stylistic matchup, but ultimately it's an odd fight.
I can tell you everything both of these fighters do. I know both guys' games very well. I have no idea what this fight's going to look like or what's going to happen in this fight. Because with Ilir Latifi, like, look back at that Ovince St. Preux fight. He drops him with an overhand left and then chokes him unconscious with a guillotine. If you can do that to Ovince St. Preux, you must be all right at MMA, right? Right? Because Ilir Latifi, I don't know if he's a good fighter disguised as an awful fighter or a really bad fighter who's just like lied his way to the top. Because I don't really know how Ilir Latifi is going to beat top level heavyweights. And it really just comes down to his size and build at this weight division. I don't know how he's going to guillotine a lot of these guys in the weight division purely based on the size and the whole logistics of it. Because my problem is, Ilir Latifi's going to have a really hard time getting guys to bring their heads down. Because A, no one's taking Ilir Latifi down at at heavyweight. Most guys, A, are going to try to, and most guys are big enough that they're just going to want to keep the fight at range and try to out-volume strike him. The flip side to that is, though, if you look at some of Ali Latifi, down at light heavyweight, he has really good power, he has the good submission ability. I just don't know if he's going to be able to crack Tanner Boser with a big enough shot to get him down to the mat to really use any of his grappling, because with Tanner Boser, he's a frustrating fighter. Let's just call it what it is. Because I do think Tanner Boser is a top 15 caliber heavyweight, but I don't know if he ever will get into the top 15 of the heavyweight division. Because he's a weird fighter, because you talk about it. He's a good striker, but he has, I don't want to say no power, but he's not a powerful striker for the division. And it's weird, because normally in heavyweight, everybody just has power because it's kind of a built-in attribute for the division. With Boser, he reminds me kind of a Michael Bisping striker, where he's not throwing his punches to knock you out. If he does knock you out with a straight right or with an accumulation of shots, that's great. But Tanner Boser's not walking into the cage looking for the knockout. He realizes that, yes, I will need 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 punch combinations to really land on my opponents. My issue is that at heavyweight, you're going to have to stand in the pocket with a lot of these guys. And if Tanner Boser is going to be standing in the pocket, trying to land with his volume, I don't look at Boser as, oh, well, he's so fleet of foot that he can really dart in, land his 2 shots, and jump out. I think he might be able to against Ali Latifi, don't get me wrong. I just think when he does end up fighting the guys, look at the top of this card, like a Walt Harris, like a Jairzinho Rozenstruik. Hell, even if he fights, let's say, a Stipe Miocic one day. Like, these are guys who have really good technical boxing on the inside. They have power for when you do try to jump in, and even when you do try to back out of these exchanges, they're going to follow you with combinations. I like the components of Tanner Boser's game. It's just, there's always something in his fights that frustrates me. And for that reason, listen, I think Tanner Boser should be Ali Latifi. I think Ali Latifi at heavyweight is one of the most out-of-position athletes in the UFC. I just think Tanner Boser, by being a little bit bigger and by having better cardio, is going to win this fight.
I mean, for Ali Latifi coming in at heavyweight, it's almost like Willian's Astudillo coming into pitch. And hey, you're going to strike out Anthony Rizzo, and then you're going to give up home runs to Yermin Mercedes when his manager doesn't really like it. But when I look at this, Latifi in his last fight weighed 246.5 pounds. Boser consistently weighs, in the last time, 232.5. Latifi's the bigger fighter in terms of weight, which is weird, and it lends credence to his grappling. If you look at it for Boser, 100% takedown defense in the UFC, hashtag stats matter, but not really, because it was 0 of 1 for Pizzola and 0 of 1 for Gon. And yeah, the Gon one holds a little bit of water, but at the same time, go back and watch the fight. It's a striking matchup. I mean, didn't need to take him down.
Last thing on Ali Latifi, too, because you brought up the Derek Lewis performance. Yes, he could take a little bit of confidence out of just losing a 29-28 decision to Derek Lewis, but here's the thing. That's a fight that nothing happened in. Like, not a lot really happened in that fight. It was just two guys who, yeah, Derek Lewis landed a little bit more in that first and third round, but it's not like Ali Latifi really separated himself in any of the rounds. Like, that was an extremely close fight because neither guy really did a lot. So, yes, Ali Latifi, it's not like he got knocked out, but he didn't do anything in that fight that really showed me that, wow, Ali Latifi showed me something at the heavyweight division that he wasn't showing me at the light heavyweight division. So at the end of the day, do I think Tanner Boser can outstrike Ali Latifi for 15 minutes? Yeah, I do. I think Latifi's going to have a hard time getting the takedown on Boser, and I think he's going to have a really hard time trying to strike the much bigger and honestly the much faster fighter in Boser. And for all those reasons, I do think Boser's going to be able to walk himself to a unanimous decision victory.
Having a look at the odds for this one, Boser open to minus 180 favorite. He's minus 202 at this point. For Latifi, open to plus 155. He's at a plus 164. And if we have a look at the total Tapology votes, 1,406 of them. 70% Boser, 50% by decision. You got 45% by knockout. For the 30% that have Latifi, 65% by decision. And like you said from the outset, Matt, this is one of those fights. One of two things is going to happen. And there's a lot of those ones on this card. But for Ali Latifi, he's at Extreme Couture. I know he's an All-Stars guy, but he spent some time at Extreme Couture getting ready for this one from the IGs. Now, I haven't seen the pictures, but there's one guy I can think of at 205 and 265 that you can get a little bit of a sense for a guy like Boser. Max Grecian is the name that comes to mind for me.
For me, Ali Latifi's losing streak really did kind of start when you look at the downfall of the All-Stars gym. Because, here, you have to remember who he was training with when he kind of went on his streak. He had Alexander Gustafsson, and Phil Davis was at All-Stars too, because you have to remember, he was training at Alliance, but also Alliance is a sister gym with All-Stars. So we had two of the better light heavyweights out there. You have a guy who's really good at striking that you practice striking with, and a guy in Phil Davis that you can get constant reps in wrestling in. Those are two of the better 205ers you can have out there for training partners. Aleer Latifi now, Gustafson's, is he retired? Does he even fight? And Phil Davis is no longer with the gym. I just feel like Aleer Latifi was one of those cases of when that gym was really flourishing and when there was a lot of talent there for him to train with, he had a lot of guys, and it was one of those iron sharpens iron ordeals. Now Latifi doesn't have the same level. Listen, I do think Max Grecian is a really good guy, and physically he does stand up next to Tanner Boser, but Max Grecian isn't like an Alexander Gustin and a Phil Davis. So for Latifi, I just don't know what version of him we're going to get at heavyweight, and honestly, I don't think we're going to get that good of a version of him in this fight. I like Tanner Boser quite a bit.
I want to see both of these guys on the scale. I've got Sweden's Latifi as it is right now.
Really?
Because again, closing the distance against a guy like Boser, I think he's going to have all kinds of success. I'm going to go with the underdog, Latifi. Matt has Tanner Boser in this fight, but I absolutely love it because again, really tough to tell what you're going to get out of this fight. You're going to have to tune in to Question Mark Kicks on Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims. There's all kinds of stragglers, and there's lots of DM messages at Fight Night Picks. Where's the show? What's the show you're talking about? Well, now you've heard it here first. Matt's got Boser. I've got Latifi. Big time heavyweights at the top in the main and the co-main. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Our next fight is something, and it's happening outside of the women's flyweight division. And I say that because both these women unranked, and they've been on the cusp before. Montana De La Rosa has had a number next to her name in the past. But we have De La Rosa taking on the Queen of Violence, Ariane Lipsky. And Matt, when I look at this fight, both fighters are very similar at just about every aspect. Now, for Lipsky, we were sold a bill of goods coming into the UFC. Former KSW champ. Is this the second coming of Karolina Kovalkiewicz? No, it was not. You look at it for Lipsky so far in the UFC, 2-3. I mean, she lost to Joanne Calderwood, who, okay, she's up there.
Good fight.
Lost to Molly McCann. All right, it's going to happen. Beats Isabella De Padua, who came in on short notice, and that fight was closer than you probably wanted out of a Lipsky fight. She then goes on to beat Luana Carolina in one of the most disgusting submissions you've seen in a while, at least I know I have. And then she loses to Antonina Shevchenko. But here's the thing. She didn't lose to Antonina Shevchenko because Shevchenko outstruck her. She lost to Antonina Shevchenko on the mat. She was held down for most of the first round. She was held down for the second round. She ends up getting finished. She ends up getting TKO'd. And it was a bit of a soft call by old King of Violence, Chris Tione. But still, she got totally mopped by Antonina Shevchenko. All right, we throw it on over to Montana De La Rosa. You know that she's accredited in terms of jiu-jitsu. Both these women are. She was an All-American and state champ at high school wrestling, but it still counts for something. And you know that that's her bread and butter. Because for Montana De La Rosa, maybe not the most comfortable striker, I'll say, to be polite. I think that's polite. I don't mean any slight by it. But when I look at this fight for De La Rosa, definitely has fought quite a high level of competition. Maybe she has lost some of those fights. But I don't mind a draw to Maeda Buena Silva in her last time out. I mean, the losses, Viviane Araujo, Andrea Lee, she beat Mara Romero Barella, who is a training partner of Ariane Lipsky at American Top Team. And then again, the other win, Nadia Kasem. But then you look at the other wins, Matt, Rachel Ostovich, Christina Marks, it's tricky.
Both of these fighters are in the same boat. These are two fighters who don't have a quality win on their record yet. Because here's the thing. For all the decent fighters that Montana De La Rosa has fought, she hasn't beaten any of them. She might have been somewhat competitive in some of those fights, but you kind of know what you're going to get from Montana De La Rosa. She's going to spam takedown attempts, and she's going to spam takedown attempts. And that's really just the bread and butter to her game. She's not much of a striker, like you would say. Kind of awkward on the feet. Very stiff, kind of, but not like the Dan Henderson way, where he's got a lot of power if he does hit you. In the, like, hey, Randy Marcos, you probably shouldn't strike kind of way. It's just with Montana De La Rosa, it's really tough, especially at this division, the 125 pounds women division, to be so one-dimensional. Because you look at the top of the division, listen, we can make fun of Caitlin Chookagian, but guess what? She's gotten a lot better throughout her UFC career. And what's she good at? She can strike at range. And she's really, really good at that. She's really hard to get taken down. It's really hard to take her down. And she has great takedowns herself. She's good at a lot of different things. Montana De La Rosa really only brings the wrestling aspect of her game into the cage with her. And that's why I really struggle to pick Montana De La Rosa versus any other well-rounded MMA fighter. But when I look at Ariane Lipsky, she kind of reminds me of when Rudy Gay went to the Raptors. Now listen, I love the Toronto Raptors probably more than I should. When Rudy Gay went there, I was told, hey, Rudy Gay, he averages like 18 a game. That's really good. Like, you know, numbers are good. And back then, I didn't know nearly as much I know about basketball, so I just looked at 18 points per game and thought, hey, that's really good. And with a record of 13-6, you're like, hey, she's not bad. Queen of Violence, good nickname. There's gonna be a really cool backstory to it. Not really. She's a fighter who gets taken down quite a bit, has decent striking, but when I look at Lipsky, it's not like her striking is good enough to really go out there and get the knockout. Like, I can't rely on Lipsky, who, even if her opponent can't strike at all, I can't really rely on Lipsky to outstrike them. So, in my mind, I just see a world where Montana De La Rosa turns this into a wrestling match, and I don't know how Ariane Lipsky can win that version of this fight.
It is a really, really tricky fight. I mean, when you do look at it in terms of the odds, this is where it scares me a bit. De La Rosa minus 140 at open. She's now minus 225 favorite, or sorry, 265. She's the biggest mover and shaker on this card, which is kind of crazy to think of, at about a 47% clip. It's De La Rosa and Dolidze, the two biggest movers and shakers. For Lipsky, open a plus 120. She's a plus 213 underdog. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, 1,344, 64% Lipsky to 36% De La Rosa. And again, not the greatest of records. And yeah, both women have losses to good fighters. So that's a really tricky thing. Who's looked better in losses? Well, De La Rosa didn't look great against Arujao, and Lipsky didn't look good against Shevchenko. We can just keep going on and on. It is a really tricky fight. I could see this one going either way. So at the end of the day, who are you going with?
I've got Montana De La Rosa strictly because I do think that this fight is only going to come down to the wrestling. And Montana De La Rosa is one of the better pure wrestlers in this division. She's not the best. She might not even be top three, but she's a decent wrestler for the flyweight division. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, Montana De La Rosa, she's going to 30-25 Ariane Lipsky, and then she's going to call out Jessica Andrade. Nothing crazy like that, but I do think she will be able to wrestle her way to a win.
It's a bit of a salty 4-2 1 in the UFC for De La Rosa. Again, 2-3 for Lipsky so far. You look at the quality of gyms, Elevation Fight Team for De La Rosa. You look at it for Lipsky, training out of American Top Team with women that are on this card. Specifically, you've got Marina Morose, but also Romero Barella, who is in her corner. You know, a little bit of consistency or familiarity there. And Janaysia Maranjan as well. So an interesting look from Lipsky. If you like her, let us know down below in the comments section. But Matt, I'm in agreement here. I've got Montana De La Rosa, although I wouldn't be putting any of my hard-earned money on this one. You can laugh about that, but it is a tricky fight. We're both going with Arlington, Texas's Montana De La Rosa. Matt, absolutely love this card. We have two big heavyweight fights up at the top. You've got Harris taking on Tybor. You got Sakai taking on Rosa Strikes. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at 145 pounds. We have Mr. Finland, the most photogenic guy on Tapology, Makwan Amerikani, taking on the Jawaian Kamuela Kirk. Absolutely love the fight because for Kamuela Kirk, this is a guy that we saw in the regional scene for the longest time. We saw him on Dana White's Contender Series. We got pummeled by Billy Quarantillo. But apart from that, put on good performances on the regional scene in the States. And you look at it, he loses to Billy Q. Lose a split decision to Bruno Souza, and then his last two times out in 2021, he finishes Guillerme Santos with LFA, and then he main events against Daniel Swain not that long ago. Oh, he's taking this fight on about a week's notice, and he fought, well, 2 weeks ago. So it's kind of weird. I mean, really, in terms of damage, he had a little bit of a mouse on one of his eyelids, and that was pretty much it. The interesting thing going into that fight against Daniel Swain was the fact that Kamuela Kirk talked in a lot of interviews about the fact that his opponent was going to quit. He was going to quit, and Michael Chiesa was on commentary with Mr. Kruk, and it was basically, man, I know Swain, I know him well, said Chiesa. He doesn't quit. What happened? Well, I'm going to quote you between the second and third rounds. I'm done, Pablo. I can't do this anymore. I'm retiring, said Daniel Swain. And why? Because Kamuela Kirk put so much pressure on him. And there's so many things to love out of his game. This is a guy that comes out of, no, not fight ready, but he does come out of a very, very close gym with Santino DeFranco. And that's the thing that I like. It's Siege MMA. I love the kicks that he brings into his game. He throws a lot of leg kicks. He throws a roundhouse to the body. He can threaten up to the head. Doesn't throw a lot of volume or combinations when he boxes, but his boxing is crisp, and he does throw with a lot of power, and he does one of the most beautiful things that I love in MMA. Left hook to the body all day, and it's usually there against the majority of his opponents. Wrestling can be a little bit of a kryptonite. We kind of saw that in the Quarantillo fight, but hey, Billy Q's a pretty good fighter. Now you're coming in on really short notice against Makwan Amerikani, former SBG guy, But here's the thing, Matt. Doesn't really train out of SBG, but kind of does. He's now out of what? MA Athletics? The Makwan Amir Khani gym.
Is Makwan Amir Khani that good at MMA?
Well, like, I mean, he knocked out Andy Ogle in 8 seconds.
No. Don't get me wrong. There's things to Makwan Amir Khani game that are good. Don't get me wrong. But when he really gets in there with other top-level competitions, he just looks terrible. Like, think about his fight with Shane Burgos. What did Shane Burgos do? I defend the takedowns, I make you tired, I box you up. Very simple. What did Edson Barbosa do? I defend the takedowns, I box you up, I make you tired. The blueprint's kind of out there for how to beat Makwan Amir Khani. This is my issue. There's some fighters out there who, listen, they might lose in different ways. They might get knocked out in one fight. They might get submitted in another fight. Makwan Amir Khani has this really disturbing trend of he loses in very similar ways in each and every one of his fights. He's a guy who, when he gets tired, he starts looking for a way out. And I don't want to question his manhood, but it's the truth. Look at the Shane Burgos fight. I will argue that Shane Burgos did not TKO him with punches. Shane Burgos TKO'd him due to fatigue. Makwan Amir Khani could barely stand at the end of that fight because the body shots that he was taking and because the fact that he could not get a takedown. He was so discouraged by the fact that he went like 1 for 13 with his takedowns, and he was so exhausted by just going panic wrestle, that if you can actually defend those takedowns, you could force Makwan Amir Khani to strike. And listen, I know I bring up Jack Hermanson a lot when I think about elite fighters who, yes, they might be a little bit uncomfortable on their feet. Makwan Amir Khani is a fighter who they're going to sell you as this guy's wrestling. Oh, one of the better wrestlers to come out of Europe in some time. Kind of. I've seen him not be able to take down other guys who aren't really great wrestlers themselves, to where I start to question how good his wrestling credentials really are. I know I'm ragging a lot on Makwan Amir Khani's game, but when I do see him in there with those upper levels of competition, and listen, a lot of guys out there are going to lose to Shane Burgos and Edson Barbosa, but this is my problem. When you've been in the UFC for a while, like Makwan Amir Khani has been, and when you've been marketed in a way that, listen, it's not like Makwan Amir Khani's like a Macy Barber where the UFC is like, this person could be a future champ, but Amir Khani's definitely more well-known than just your average unranked fighter. He's marketed in a way that, listen, Makwan Amir Khani should be in the top 15, and he's been given a lot of opportunities to really showcase his talent against top levels of competition. But let's think back at even some of his biggest wins. Jason Knight dropped him three times. Shane Burgos pieced him up on the feet. Like, I just have so many questions and concerns about the striking of Makwan Amir Khani that, listen, yes, he might go out there completely out-wrestle Kamwela Kirk. I could see that. But there's also another world where Kirk just defends his takedowns, and he forces Makwan Amir Khani to become the shell of himself that we've seen in that third round, and he could just start teeing off on him. It really just comes down to who has the wrestling edge. Is it going to come down to the wrestling offense of Amir Khani or the wrestling defense of Kirk?
Now, for Kirk, in a lot of his fights, he really pushes a crazy pace in terms of his pressure, not necessarily his volume, but his pressure. He's a pressure-oriented fighter, and I look at it, and this is where it kind of scares me a little bit. But with Kirk, BJJ black belt from the research that I've done, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but that's what I read and that's what I saw from Overtime Heroics, who I trust by and large. I do, they do a good job. Now, that was out of the preview for the Swain fight. Now, getting ready for a fight with Makwan Amir Khani. You know how slippery he is on the ground. He submitted Chris Fishgold, and you can laugh at Chris Fishgold in the UFC, but former Cage Warriors champ and a hell of a grappler if he's anything. He also submitted Danny Henry in his last win. The fight against Barboza is weird because it was really short notice and you're taking on a hell of a striker and
destroyed.
You get absolutely destroyed in a decision, but it was completely lopsided. So I look at this fight as an interesting one. Now for Kirk, the fight against Swain was on short notice as well. And it was at 155 pounds. They have him listed at 155.8. This fight's at featherweight on less than like 2 weeks' notice, like a week's notice. So now you're just worried about cutting the weight. But the guy has the experience enough on the ground. We saw even Swain threatening with the armbar. We saw him threatening on the ground. He wanted that fight on the ground. And Kirk kind of gave it to him at points, but he was able to get out of all the really tough positions. So I'm eager to see this. I think if Kamwela Kirk came out with a game plan where I'm just going to blitz volume at Amir Khani, it could make it a really interesting fight, especially where the line's at. Like, you look at it, Amir Khani open a minus 305, he's a minus 280 right now. Kirk open a minus 225, he's a plus 219. And if we have a look at Tapology, 1,015 total votes, 92% Amir Khani, 62% by submission. I mean, I think it's kind of silly, but like, I can definitely see a world where Makwan is a submission specialist if he's anything. And if you look at his total wins by finish, it is primarily by, let's see, 11 by submission, 1 by knockout. But I have a hard time with MA Athletic here.
this is Amir Khani's fight to lose. It really should be.
Yeah, I agree.
He's been in the UFC for much longer, has much more experience against the highest level of competition, too. I could see this fight kind of going like, remember when Brad Riddell fought Magomed Mustafayev?
It's the exact fight of Dakota Bush and Austin Hubbard.
I feel like my comp was good, so I'm just going to keep on going with it, where Riddell would get immediately taken down, but he'd be able to pop back up to his feet. And yes, he would lose in the wrestling aspect of the fight, but in the clinch, he would make sure he would get damage off. On the feet, he would always make sure that he was winning the exchanges, and he would just do enough that, yes, he might lose the wrestling, but he won the war afterwards. And yes, Brad Riddell won that very, very close fight. I could see Kirk having a similar game plan to Riddell, but this is my issue. Brad Riddell is one of the best strikers in the world, and he really just, he's built his whole game around, I defend takedowns, I stand up, I use my Muay Thai striking. With Amir Khani, he's better than just that initial takedown attempt. He can force the scramble to a certain degree. I know he couldn't get it done against Edson Barboza or Shane Burgos. I do think he'll be able to get it done against Kamwela Kirk. I don't think Makhwan Amir Khani can beat elite competition. I don't, and I'm going to tell you that right now. But I do think he's going to be able to get it done this Saturday.
I'm going to go fishing again, Matt. Kamwela Kirk, again, submission win over Kevin Kroom not that long ago. You look at the losses. I mean, Billy Q, where the stat line's silly. Significant strikes per minute. Again, you don't ever want to look into these. Yeah, but when you see a number where the line, like the bar goes further than where it's supposed to go, 5.31 in that one fight per minute to 12.25 absorbed. It's not good, but it's Billy Q. But still, I do like the game of Kamwela Kirk. I'm sure if it's Santino DeFranco in the corner from Siege MMA, they're going to have a good game plan, even on short notice against a guy like Makhwan Amir Khani. And again, for Amir Khani getting ready for this fight, where it wasn't supposed to be Kirk, it was supposed to be Nate Landwehr. A similar enough opponent, but I do like the parts and parcels of Kirk's game. I like that jiu-jitsu black belt in his back pocket. So I'm going to go with the underdog here. I've got Kamwela Kirk to get the win. You've got Mr. Finland, Makhwan Amir Khani, but I absolutely love the fight. It is very, very interesting right here on the paper. Can't wait to hear who you have in this one. Matt, big fights in our main and co-main, both at heavyweight. You're not going to want to miss those. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Strangest fight on the card, and I feel like we said that a couple of times. At middleweight, we have England's Tom Breese taking on Brazil's Antonio Arroyo. And for Antonio Arroyo, we were sold a bill of goods, and we were expecting Thiago Santos Light, and what did we get? We got a guy that got submitted by Andre Muniz and lost one of the weirdest decisions to Deron Wynn his last time out in one of the most lackluster fights of recent memory. And for Tom Breese, he was a guy that was kind of promised to be that next big thing at 170 pounds. And we know the circumstances around why that didn't happen. But ultimately, he came back last year and he put on a performance. Now, listen, again, KB Buller, is he of the same ilk of Antonio Arroyo? We don't know yet. But for KB, he got knocked down on the seat of his pants by a power jab and Tom Breese looked amazing. And for Tom Breese, his other win prior to that, that we'd seen somewhat recently, almost 3 years ago, was against Judo Dan Kelly, who's in the corner of some notable fighters these days out of Australia. So Tom Breese beats KB Buller. We know how high his ceiling can be. His jiu-jitsu is great. His wrestling is decent. His striking is powerful and crisp. He's a complete package. Like, if you saw a silhouette of Tom Breese fighting, it's like Jerry West. You know it's Tom Breese. If you know Tom Breese enough, you know him. And he goes out there against Omari Akhmedov, and you knew what Akhmedov was going to do. I'm just going to spam the takedowns. I'm going to work it. And he did. Breese got him in some compromising positions. He did. He was trying so hard for Kimuras. He was going for guillotines. He was going for everything. And by the end of the first round of that fight, he had him backpacked. He had the body lock. If it went another 45 seconds, I'm being generous, maybe he would have submitted him. We get into the second round. Tom Breese grabs another Kimura, flips on his own head. Akhmedov gets on top, and referee Lukasz Bukowski said, "Hey, Tom, that's cool, but that head and arm triangle is going to put you to sleep." And it did, and it was a weird ending. For Breese, looking to get back on the horse. For Antonio Arroyo, the horse left. Hopefully it comes back.
Okay, we're talking about Tom Breese, Omari Akhmedov. Like, it's one of the great, like, what-ifs in UFC history. It was enjoyable. It was a weird fight. Seriously, with Tom Breese, yeah, he's good at jiu-jitsu. Yeah, he's got decent wrestling. But he is a fighter that I've seen get out grappled in his fights. And it is weird. And it's a very frustrating thing. And you can shrug your shoulders if you want to. But, like, Tom Breese is in the category of middleweights with guys like Brennan Allen, with guys like Sean Strickland, with guys, you know, guys who are very, very good, but they're not quite ranked yet. They're still great fighters. they're more than entry-level UFC fighters, I would say, but they just really haven't had their opportunity against the best fighters in the division. But the weird thing with Tom Breeze is that I've seen him with some of those top-level fighters in the division. Omari Akhmedov, listen, you might not like his game, and yeah, he's not the most aesthetically pleasing fighter to watch, but, like, he's a tough guy to beat. And unless you are really good at wrestling, and unless you have good cardio and you're a decent striker, like, it's a tough night in the office to beat a guy like Omari Akhmedov. But we expect Tom Breeze to beat Akhmedov. That's what I mean. We talk about Tom Breeze like he's one of those guys. Like, he is one of those 15 to 20 guys. And here's the thing. Tom Breeze, on his best day, I do think could be one of those guys. But when you do look at him in the Akhmedov fight, have sort of, I don't want to say mental lapses, but just there's some positions that he does struggle in more than others, where Tom Breeze in top position, much like Sarah McMahon, for instance, he's very good, can get a lot of damage off, he's got great ground and pound himself, and you talk about some of the submissions, he's got great control too from the top position, but he's a fighter who on the bottom, I just don't know what it is. I don't know if he's almost too comfortable off the bottom to where he's kind of okay with fighters in his guard, or if he just struggles in the bottom position to get back up to his feet. It could be one or the other. I don't really have the answer for you. I do think he's going to be the better grappler than Antonio Ahoyu, but it's frustrating when we do talk about how good the grappling of Tom Breeze is, but when you do see him in there with other guys around his skill level, he does seem to get out-grappled by those guys. Like, listen, yes, the Brennan Allen fight might have been weird, but at the end of the day, he got ground and pounded on the ground. And yes, the Akhmedov fight, he had some areas where he was doing well, but at the end of the day, he still got submitted. For Tom Breeze, in my head, I've got this like top 10 to 15 fighter who can go out there and box a lot of guys very similar to a Sean Strickland, and who can take other guys down, who will offer him some trouble on the feet. I think he's going to beat Antonio Ahoyo, don't get me wrong, but I just think that's because Antonio Ahoyo hasn't really shown me enough that he's a UFC caliber fighter. And that's really the flip side of this that I want to hand it off to you. I don't look at Antonio Ahoyo as a UFC caliber guy. When we talk about Tom Breeze, we talk about a guy who on his best day might be top 15. Antonio Ahoyo's best day, I don't even know if he could beat a lot of guys on Contender Series.
So the trouble with me and Antonio Ahoyo, he's going to go up against Andrea Muniz. And listen, we know how good Muniz is now. We knew how credentialed he was in terms of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But you look at the fight against Ahoyo, and Ahoyo's a plus 100 underdog. Okay, that's fine. Muniz beats him. Then he goes in to fight Deron Winn. He's a minus 180 favorite. I'm going to read you a comment from under our video.
I picked Deron Winn.
For Winn and Ahoyo. The comment was, Ahoyo has good BJJ. I don't think Winn will win or be able to hold him down. Are you silly?
Does Antonio Ahoyo's jiu-jitsu teacher the same guy who gave Thiago Santos his black belt?
I don't know. I mean, the trouble for me, I look at this. So for Tom Breeze, he trains at a Team Renegade BJJ. Jai Herbert, who we talked about earlier, coming from that gym, but also the Edwards brothers. Aiden Lee, who's got a really big fight coming up with Bellator. Like, very credentialed guys. Now, again, Fabian, closer in terms of weight, same as Leon. Jai, not so much. Neither is Aiden Lee. But still, good fighters. Oh, yeah. And one of them's going to fight Aaron Pico soon. And so good fighters and guys who are good at jiu-jitsu. And that's it. For Tom Breeze, it's almost like, hey, it's another chance to go out there on the mat. We get to have a little bit of fun because I'm a better striker than most of these guys. Now, for Antonio Ahoyo, the buck might stop there. I mean, this is a guy that started out in Muay Thai, went to school for business. I mean, hey, neat stuff to study that. I studied that in university. Cool. Cool stuff, man. But to get into MMA at that point, or sorry, to get into Muay Thai at that point, have three Muay Thai fights go pro as an MMA fighter, win, and then the weird thing is, four wins by knockout, four by submission. Yeah, okay, like, you're submitting guys on the regional scene, but you come into the UFC. Muniz, again, the highest of level. He fights Deron Winn, and I cannot stress enough the height disadvantage Deron Winn was at. He's 5'6", fighting a guy that's 6'3". Ahoyo looked lost, he couldn't defend the takedowns, and he gassed against the guy that gasses. Like, again, you win by submission against Felipe Oliveira, 0-0 in 2016. You win by, what, rear naked choke against Adriano Miranda. Ooh. To get into Dana White's Contender Series. What was Miranda in 2018? 1-1. Like, these aren't high-level jiu-jitsu practitioners. Listen, I understand. Antonio Ahoyo, they bring in because he looks like Thiago Santos on the feet. He has really good kicks. We know how good of a kicking game he has. But his game is almost non-existent on the ground. And that's what we've seen so far against decent competition. He's training now out of Jackson Wink. In the pictures, Maurice Green, Devin Clark. Now, Devin Clark's going to be a great guy to train with. Getting ready for a fight like this, or any fight at middleweight, you're going to shore up those defensive holes and lapses that you've had in other fights. But I haven't felt this incensed and almost enraged at a fight. Because I like, I don't think he's going to knock Tom Breeze out. And he certainly, I don't think he's going to finish him on the ground. Like, it's a weird fight.
So we both have Tom Breeze, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the odds, Tom Breeze is about a minus 250 favorite right now. Ahoyo plus 200. 92% of 1,370 total voters have Breeze to win on Tapology. 46% by decision, 42% by knockout. Antonio, if you're out there somewhere, I hope you do well. I wish you nothing but success. I don't mean anything personally. I don't have him in this fight. If he wins, again, kudos. But yeah, I've got Breeze.
This is a great fight for Tom Breeze to get back on the horse. He got a taste of a ranked fighter in his last performance. He was not able to meet expectations. But now you're going down to Antonio Ahoyo. I look at Ahoyo, and I think he's much closer to KB Buller than I do think he's to Omari Akhmedov. Like, I don't think Antonio Ahoyo is going to be in the top 15 anytime soon. I got to be honest, I don't even know how much longer he'll be in the UFC. I do like Tom Breeze quite a bit in this.
Yeah, fight. I mean, unless Tom Breeze misses a flight or doesn't wake up for the fight. So, I've got Breeze in this fight. I can't wait for it, Matt. We have big-time fights on our main card, including this, but two big heavyweight fights up at the top. So you're not going to want to miss those. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time banger coming up this weekend at 185 pounds, replacing Maki Pitolo. We have Gregory Rodriguez, and man, is he coming in at a good time. I like this fight almost more than the original booking, taking on Dusko Todorovic. And Matt, holy smokes. I mean, for Gregory Rodriguez, you look at it, and this is a guy that a lot of people probably counted out. His last loss was on Contender Series. He got finished by Jordan Williams, who punched his ticket to the UFC. So what does Rodriguez do? He doesn't sit there and slouch. Goes back to LFA, and a little bit over a month and a half ago, almost 2 months ago, he fights Al Matavao. And you might go, Craig, well, you've talked some smack about Al Matavao here in the past. And yes, I have, but he finished him. That's a decent win. You finish a guy like that, that's great. And then on short notice, he fights Josh Fremm over with LFA for the middleweight belt, and it was vacant. Think of all the great middleweights they've had in LFA that have held that belt. Brennan Allen being one
Eric
of them.
Eric Anders?
Eric Anders being another one. So many great. Marcus Perez, another one. Like, we could go on Chuck all day.
Ballin?
No.
No, he was a welterweight.
We could go on forever. But for Rodriguez, RoboCop, he's coming in here with a head of steam. Again, that fight that he took. Now, listen, it wasn't 2 days and 16 hours ago. But yeah, it was just last weekend. So now he's going to fight again this week. Taking on Dusko. I mean, holy smokes, a tough fight. But if anybody can do it, maybe it's him?
This is going to be a very, very fun fight. And with Dusko, I don't really know where to start. I guess I'll just start where he's not what I thought he would be. And I'm going to put a lot of stock into his last performance just because I kind of have to. Dusko is one of those fighters who he can either fix the issue he had in his last fight in one camp, or it's going to be an issue for him his whole entire career. Because in his last fight, he kept on getting hit by the exact same punch over and over, and over, and over, and over again. He got hit by so many overhand lefts that it's the last time I've seen that many techniques just land over and over and over again. It was odd because you would think, okay, you get hit by it once, you'd kind of adjust afterwards. But Dusko has this weird habit of, he pulls out of exchanges with his chin very high up and his hands very low down. And the best example I can give to you is Edson Barbosa when he fought Justin Gaethje. Think of when Edson was trying to circle outside of the power of Justin Gaethje, and Justin Gaethje throws that big hook that meets Edson as he's circling out. That's kind of the perfect punch to land on a guy with his hands down, but that's how Dusko pulls out of every single exchange. And if we're really going to give Gregory Rodriguez his flowers, he does have really good power in his hands and with both hands too. He's good from the orthodox and from the southpaw, or at least he has good power from both sides. And when you're fighting a guy like Dusko, who, yes, I think Dusko is the more well-rounded guy on the feet. I think he's the more, I should say, polished striker out of these two. But the fact that Dusko has such a big issue with his defense on the feet, he's going to give a lot of guys who maybe technically aren't on his level a chance to beat him every time he steps into the cage.
And I mean, if you look at it for Dusko, I mean, gets the win on Contender Series over Canadian Teddy Ash in a fight that was back and forth. They were both bloody. Great fight. He beats Daquan Townsend in a fight that wasn't overly close when it happened. He beats Michelle Paella to land over on Contender Series. And then he loses to Puna Soriano. And again, we didn't give Puna the credit we should have. And he came into the comment section after that and let us know it. But I mean, yeah, it's really weird because he just totally abandons all striking defense for the offense. And he really likes to march opponents down. And against Rodriguez, you not only have to worry about the striking, but the jiu-jitsu. And this is a guy, again, he was a plus 190 underdog in that fight on May 21st. Matt, we're filming this, and we're
kind
what?
Kind of wild.
We're what, the 28th?
Seven?
No, we're the 31st. So, okay. Tapology has their dates wrong, but really it is a quick turnaround for the man representing Brazil coming out of Sanford MMA. And I watched an interview, and this was an interesting one. Do it if you have the chance over on Facebook with Gabriel Gonzalez, MMA Uncaged. The reason why Rodriguez came to the States was because his friends from Brazil wanted to open a church and they needed help. So he's like, yeah, okay, I'll help you out. Then he started training at Kings MMA, got to work in with Cordero. Then he went to Florida and boom, like Bob's your uncle. It's kind of crazy to hear that story. I don't love the loss to Jordan Williams because, again, like I've seen Jordan Williams have a halfway competitive fight against Kazula Vargas at Tachi Palace. And then I've seen him lose to Nasruddin Imavov, who's a good fighter. Like, it's really hard to tell.
And this is my issue. I don't want to put too much weight into the loss to Puto Soriano from Todorovic. Because this is the thing. He might have just looked bad in that fight. And maybe he comes out in this fight. He shored up some of those defensive holes. He does have the good combinations. He does have the aggressiveness that we really enjoy. And maybe he goes out there and knocks out Rodriguez in the first 3 minutes. There could be a world where the hand speed and just the combinations of Todorovic give Rodriguez a lot of trouble. This fight for me comes down to, can Gregory catch Todorovic when he's in the pocket? Or can Rodriguez make this an MMA fight? Because if he can incorporate the takedown, or at least make Todorovic think about the takedown, lower the already low hands of Todorovic, then maybe he could catch him with a big hook on the exit in one of these exchanges. But for me, this is a fight where I'm going to look stupid no matter what I say, because if I say Dusko Todorovic is going to win, he's probably going to get caught by a big overhand and then submitted on the ground. And if I say Rodriguez is going to win, Todorovic is probably going to go in there, hit him with one blitz, and knock him out up against the cage. It's one of those fights that really is just that volatile going both ways.
Dusko open a minus 250. He's a minus 165 favorite. Rodriguez open a plus 210. He's now a plus 135. We have a look over on Tapology. 1,171 total votes. 83% going with Dusko. 72% by knockout for the 17% that have Rodriguez. 77% by knockout. So you're probably going to get a finish. Maybe you're looking at the over-under. 2.5, 1.5. That's the interesting one to go with. I mean, I don't like the striking defense of Todorovic, but at the same time, Rodriguez is coming in on such short a notice. I'll side with Todorovic, who was getting ready for a striker anyway, but I have a really tough time with this one.
And I kind of default on the same thing. I had really high hopes for Todorovic before his last performance. So if I do take out his last performance, I would assume Todorovic would beat Rodriguez. But the fact that his striking defense was so poor does leave a little bit of doubt in my mind. But at the end of the day, I do have to agree with you, and I do have to pick Dusko Todorovic. I do think his hand speed really is the edge in this fight. But again, if I woke up on Sunday morning because I somehow missed these fights, and Gregory Rodriguez landed an overhand right into a guillotine, I would not be surprised in the least bit.
Pop and Popcorn both going with Serbia's own. Absolutely love the fight. Big time card. Two heavyweight fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss them. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have a new nickname for the Argentinian Santiago Ponzinibbio. It is the Argentine Dagger. He's going to be taking on Miguel Baeza, coming out of MMA Masters, undefeated at 10-0. His last two fights, a knockout over Matt Brown, performance of the night. A submission victory over Takashi Sato, performance of the night. Amazing, amazing fights we've seen from him so far in his young career in the octagon. Before that, a knockout win over Hector Aldana. He came in off of a decision win over Victor Reyna on Contender Series. But man, holy smokes, Miguel Baeza, one of the hottest prospects in the division. And now he's taking on a guy who I would consider welterweight's Gautier, because now you're just somebody that I used to know. I mean, for Ponzinibbio, it was future champ for the longest time. I mean, look at his last win before he went away. Huge. I mean, Matt, let's go the five on in. We're talking about Nordin Taleb, Gunnar Nelson, Mike Perry, Neil Magny, where he finished him late in the fight. It was great. And then he had a long layoff due to a multitude of injuries. And he came back and he took on Li Jingliang and he got finished in the first round. And that was in 2021. So for the former, what was it, Gente Boa, but now Argentine Dagger, Santiago Ponzinibbio, it is tricky to try and weigh the probabilities of what you're going to get. Because, again, there were so many different fight bookings, so many different injuries, life-threatening, career-threatening, and he made it back. And listen, it was great to see him fight Li Jingliang. But they're not doing him any favors giving him Miguel Baeza.
Well, they're not. But this is the problem that Santiago Ponzinibbio kind of has. Like, when you were that, I'm going to say Argentina's best chance for UFC gold. I know that term gets thrown around a lot where any Italian fighter, Canadian fighter, that's what the broadcast likes to say. Like, oh, this fighter's their country's best chance to win gold. But for Ponzinibbio, it was the truth. Like, he was in the top 10. He was knocking people out cold. And I mean, really, that's enough in most divisions to get yourself a title shot. And the fact that he was supposed to be matched up with Kamaru Usman in Argentina, like, everything was starting to build for Santiago Ponce to be, really be one of the stars of the welterweight division. Then he breaks his hand, can't fight Usman, gets a staph infection, and we all kind of know the story, right? It's been injury after injury after injury. And if you want to tell the story of Santiago Ponce to be and try to look forward to predict his next fight against Miguel Baeza, you really have to ask yourself how much stock you're going to put into the Li Jingliang performance. Because you can look at that fight in two different ways. You can look at that fight as, well, he lost to a fairly good striker in Jingliang, who has really good power on the feet. He is a crafty boxer, who is a weird fighter to fight. Or you can look at it similar to, and I know this comp isn't going to be perfect, but just hear me out. You can look at it like when Mackenzie Dern came back as Amanda Ribas. Extended layoff, for different reasons, mind you, but extended layoff. Kind of getting your body back into fighting shape, and that was your first time back in a full camp. You could look at it as, hey, Ponce de Leon, he's a little bit older, he might just need one more camp under his belt to really get back into MMA shape. And if you're looking at this fight as, oh, this is 100% Santiago Ponce de Leon, the guy who was knocking out Neil Magny, Gunnar Nelson, Nordine Taleb, and I guess he beat him by decision in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, but like, Ponce de Leon was that guy, and if you think he is still that top 10 talent at the welterweight division, then you kind of have to predict that he's going to beat Miguel Baeza, because the fighter that Ponce de Leon was before he did have his long layoff, without question, should beat Miguel Baeza. With me, I'm just asking myself, what version of Ponce de Leon are we going to get? Because if we're getting a 70% Ponce de Leon who can't take a shot like he used to be able to, is a little bit more hesitant than he once was, then I do think Baeza should win this fight. But let's say that last fight was a bit of a one-off. Was that bump in the road? Like, listen, Dustin Poirier got knocked out by Michael Johnson. Fighters have weird knockout losses on their careers that, listen, you can put a lot of stock into them, you can put no stock into them. They're just results. So let's say you do think Ponce de Leon is still that top 15 fighter, then he should go out there and knock out Miguel Baeza. We've seen Miguel Baeza struggle with guys who do push him backwards. Yes, he knocked out Matt Brown, but like, you gotta remember, Matt Brown had success in that fight. When Matt Brown was moving forward on Miguel Baeza, he didn't drop Baeza. Like, he did have some success in that fight. Now, Baeza showed great heart, came back and knocked
Matt
Brown
out. Rolled with the punches.
Still got dropped, but anyways, he was able to come back against a crafty vet. I like what I've seen from Baeza, but this is such a big step up in competition for Baeza that it's really one of those sink or swim fights.
I mean, to be able to go out there and strike with Takashi Sato, to get him down on the mat and to submit him, that's huge. That's a really, really big win. Like, you have to put stock into that. Now you get a really big jump up to Ponce de Leon, but again, I mean, who the hell is this Santiago Ponce de Leon at this point? I have no idea. So I'm sitting here. I have no idea what you're going to get. Because he looked like a shell of himself in his last fight. Like, he looked rusty. He looked slow. He was just didn't even look like the old guy that we knew and loved.
Go that far.
It was bad.
Well, okay, this thing with Ponce de Leon, he's never going to throw a great amount of volume. Like, if you are going to beat him on the feet, you can out-volume him. I look at Ponce de Leon very similar to how I look at Paul Felder, where is he like, top tier for power? Not really. Is he top tier for volume? No, like, he's kind of in that weird in-between, you know? He can knock you out. He can overwhelm you with his volume. But for the most part, he's just kind of that single-strike striker who has great technique. And if he does catch you clean, he will put you out. But if not, then he will kind of look bad.
Yeah, and I mean, for Miguel Baeza, 7 of his 10 wins by knockout. We can play MMA math as long as we want to, but really riding a great wave of thunder into this one. And for Ponce de Leon, I have a hard time seeing, you know, if it's the slower fighter that we saw the last time out, he's going to struggle with the power and the speed of Baeza in a fight like this. And when you really look at it in terms of the odds, Ponce de Leon opened the favorite, minus 140, he's a minus 101 right now. Baeza opened at a plus 120, he's a minus 122. And over on Tapology, and I actually did look at this one earlier today because yes. I threw the tweet out there. 2 or 3 years ago, if they matched these two guys up, 1,427 total votes, 67% Baeza, and 74% having to win by knockout, 33% with Ponce de Leon, 45% by decision, to 45, 46% by knockout. You'd shake your head and you wouldn't believe me if I threw those numbers at you, but we're at where we're at right now. I mean, Ponce de Leon, it's sink or swim, and here's the opportunity.
I still think those numbers are kind of ridiculous, if we're being completely honest. Like, to me, this is a very 50-50 fight, for these reasons. if I've seen Matt Brown drop you at 39 years old, then Ponce DiNibbio can definitely do it. Like, Ponce DiNibbio still has the power and still does have the hand speed to where if he does connect on you, you're gonna go down. Those things don't just leave. I do worry a little bit about the hand injuries of Ponce DiNibbio, but at the end of the day, I do think people are putting too much stock in the Li Jingliang performance. I think Ponce DiNibbio can still go out there and beat good fighters. Is Baeza the guy who's gonna be able to go out there and beat? I don't think he can. I do think the volume of Baeza will eventually get to Ponce DiNibbio, and the fact that, listen, Ponce DiNibbio, even against Mike Perry, when Mike Perry was able to back Ponce DiNibbio up, and when Ponce DiNibbio couldn't set his feet and throw, then you can get to Ponce DiNibbio. I do think if Baeza can keep a constant forward pressure and avoid the one big counter punch coming back his way from Ponce DiNibbio, then he should be able to win this fight. But again, if Ponce DiNibbio, think back to Andre Koroshkov, Douglas Lima number two, where Koroshkov, he's having success on the feet. He has Lima up against the cage and he's doing great, but Lima throws that one big bomb that lands in the best spot, or it lands in the right spot on the chin, and he wins by knockout. I could see this fight maybe ending by one of those Hail Mary shots, but I do have to pick Baeza.
Yeah, I mean, listen, and I'll lend credence to what you said. Brown did rock him for sure. They don't list it as a knockdown on UFC stats. Baeza got two, but yeah, he rolled with the punches. We'll call it that.
They're gaslight.
But Matt, we're both going with Miguel Baeza in this fight. Absolutely love it. This should be a great one. We added as a possible fight of the night for sure. Oh. You have three great fights left on this card. Make sure you check out those videos. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. In 2021, Phil Haas, Charles Oliveira, I mean, your favorite fighter on the regional scene, they just pulled an M&M and they decided to absolutely go platinum blonde. And yeah, Oliveira did it a little bit earlier. For Laureano Staropoli, we're looking to just kind of follow the wave of success. You can see it on screen. Platinum blonde Pepe is like a totally different mythical figure. And for this guy, yeah, it hasn't worked out his last couple of fights. We have Laureano Staropoli taking on Roman Delice. And Matt, we've talked about Roman Delice's credentials time and time and time again. FILA World Grappling Champion. He's an ADCC champion. You see it in his fights, the fact that this guy is going to want to take you down. He's going to want to grab your leg. He's going to want to take it home with him. And I don't know if he's going to eat it for dinner. I don't know what he's going to do. But lately, training out of Extreme Couture, getting ready for his last number of fights. And the weird thing about Delice is, as credentialed of a grappler as he is, and as questionable of cardio as he might have, what does he do in his fights? Keeps his hands really low and strikes like he's a Muay Thai artist. And he will throw spinning kicks. He will throw spinning back fists. We saw that in his fight against Mr. Pasternak, Michael Pasternak to be specific, with WWFC about 2.5 years ago. And now, did Roman have a little bit of a USADA issue and did it keep him out of his UFC debut a couple of times? Sure. Sure, but it happens. And listen, the wait was worth it. Same thing with Alexander Romanov. So far in the UFC, Delice's beaten Hadis Ibrahimov. Maybe not the best name. He's beaten John Allen by split. It was a close fight, but I had Delice in that one. And his last time out, that damn power jab, Matt, at Trevin Giles. Giles was just able to outbox him. And for Delice, listen, he does the thing where he does a creepy Cheshire smile or Cheshire cat smile. But this guy can get a little frustrated in the cage. Could be interesting against a very, very good striker in Laureano Staropoli.
I don't know if he's a very, very good striker. He's an all right striker. This is a weird fight because this fight's the first time in a very long time where I've asked myself, like, is size going to dictate who wins this fight? Because I really do think this is one of those fights where you're going to see a massive size difference between both athletes. Because yes, Staropoli might be, like, he might be listed at the same height or maybe even an inch taller. He's the much smaller guy physically, though, when they do step into the cage. Roman Delice would have to cut off both arms to make 170 pounds. It would be impossible for him to ever make welterweight in his life. Whereas Staropoli, we're talking about it. Yes, he is a big welterweight, don't get me wrong, but he can still make that weight. Whereas Delice, he's the guy who fought at 205 pounds.
Not that long ago, surprised that he even made 185. To go into that Trevin Giles fight, I went in with a lot of trepidation. That was a, you gotta wait for question mark kicks because I want to see Delice make the weight. And was it a close fight? Eh, not so much. Now, Laureano's coming in on short notice for this one. It was originally supposed to be Alessio Di Chirico, Roman Delice. So again, when you're getting ready for Di Chirico, well-rounded, owns his own gym out of Rome. He's kind of like Italy's Makwan Amerikani with MA Athletics or training, whatever it is. But in this fight, now you have the Argentinian in Pepe getting ready for this fight with the striking. some similarities that you can draw out of Di Chirico, but that's pretty much where the buck ends in the fact that they strike.
Roman De Ligia, too, he's weird because when I think of him, I know Joe Rogan used to always say, Dominic Cruz, if you saw a silhouette of him, you'd know it'd be him just because the way he moves. De Ligia does move like one other MMA fighter, and Craig might know who I'm about to say because I think I've made this reference once before. He moves like Fedor Emelianenko. It's weird. It's not the best comp because, listen, Fedor, in the grand scheme of things, is like MMA Mount Rushmore type material. And De Ligia, listen, he's 8-1. He has a lot to prove. But stylistically, they move the same way. They both have this weird kind of shuffling movement to the way that they move. They both carry their hands extremely low.
He can lunge.
And they both... With De Ligia, though, he throws everything into every punch that he throws, but the difference is that De Ligia doesn't have the absurd and really unique hand speed that Fedor Emelianenko did. Emelianenko, even now, has pretty good hand speed at his advanced age, whereas De Ligia, if they land, they're going to hurt, don't get me wrong. But it's the fact that all of his big shots don't land. I was thinking, and I always forget Zabit when we talk about this, but Zabit's kind
best of... Best wishes, just come back safe.
Yeah, for sure, but just when I think about Zabit... He throws a lot of really cool-looking techniques. How many of them land? Not very many. It's cool to throw 720 spin kicks, but if you're not landing any of them, then I really don't care at the end of the day. With De Ligia, that's kind of his problem. You do bring up the kicks. You do bring up the spinning back fist. I'm going to bring up another comparison with Mirab Dvalishvili. Roman De Ligia is a guy who does fall in love with some of those techniques, and he's not like Israel Adesanya, who he's throwing his strikes with like perfect technique, and he's going to make sure that the defense is just as good as the offense. He's a guy who will sacrifice defense in pursuit of more offense, and that's going to really cost him against guys at 185. Think about Uriah Hall, for instance. Uriah Hall is fighting Sean Strickland, a guy who's not even a ranked fighter right now. So Uriah Hall himself, let's just say, is a fringe-ranked fighter. Could you imagine if Roman De Ligia had to fight Uriah Hall?
Ugh.
Exactly. And I don't want to say amateurish striking, because with De Ligia, he does have the power that can really cover up a lot of the holes that he does have in some of his striking. But let's say De Ligia did fight a guy like Uriah Hall. Uriah Hall's going to let you throw all those windmill punches, and he's going to let you miss. A lot and a lot and a lot. He's going to be comfortable with your misses, and he's going to make you pay with one shot. I do think that there's guys out there who can really make Roman De Ligia pay for his really, I'll just say, undisciplined style, for lack of a better term. I just don't think Staropoli is going to be that guy. I do think on the feet, Laureano can offer Roman. He's going to throw those straight punches. He is going to stifle some of the attacks. But at the end of the day, if De Ligia is going to get a take, is going to be searching for a takedown, I think he's going to be able to get it. I do think that his grappling is better. I do think that the size advantage is really going to play a big part in this fight. And for De Ligia, he didn't look great against Trevor Giles, but I do think this is a chance to get right back on the horse.
You look at it for Laureano, coming into the UFC, beat Hector Aldana, who we've already talked about on this card. He beat Thiago Alves about 2 years ago. Loses to Muslim Salikov. All right, it's going to happen. Lost to Tim Means in a fight where we were all over Laureano.
Tim Means looked good, though.
Tim Means looked pretty good in that one. But again, totally different fighters than Roman De Ligia.
And that's what I was going to say, too. Even if you want to bring up the Tim Means fight, like, oh, he lost to Tim Means, he's going to lose to Roman De Ligia. Tim Means, technically, is really, really good. Like, they're the opposite, kind of. Because Tim Means, well, what's his technique? His technique's almost perfect. He throws really good boxing combinations. He can overwhelm his opponents with volume. Whereas De Ligia, he's kind of just that, like, I'm going to aim from the hip and hope for the best. But if I do hit you with that aim from the hip, it is going to put you down. So for Staropoli, I don't think it's as easy of, oh, he got beaten by the smaller guy in his last fight, and that's why he's going to lose this fight. But I do think the size is going to play a major factor in this.
And it's a tricky fight for De Ligia. I mean, again, you got beaten by Trevin Giles with the striking, and if Staropoli just stick and move, pumps a jab out there, throws a few kicks, and doesn't leave it out there, then he should have success. But again, if you have a look at the odds for this one, De Ligia open a +130 underdog. That line corrected itself automatically. He's a -146 favorite for Staropoli. He opened a -130. He's a +120 at this point. If we have a look at the topology votes, 1,308 votes. 90% De Ligia, 65% by decision. I have George's Roman De Ligia in this fight. He is very much, and it's tough, my Adolfo Vieira in this division. And if I've said it, well, they're in the same division, but if I've said it once, I've said it twice, but I do have De Ligia in this fight. It brings me great trepidation to say that, but I've got him.
I wish Staropoli was a little bit taller. I wish he was a bit more of a baller. No, listen, I do think if Staropoli was a little bit bigger, he would make this a much more competitive fight. But at the end of the day, I like the grappling of De Ligia, and I do really like the size advantage that he should have in the cage by Saturday. I also like Roman De Ligia.
Both going with Extreme Couture's Roman De Ligia to get the win. Can't wait for this fight. We have two big fights ahead of this, both of them at heavyweight. Stick around for those. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Father's Day is coming, and the weather's catching heat. So whether you have a dad bod or rocking the six-pack or the Go Habs Go jersey, you suck, Leafs. Make sure that you and your dad are smelling nice and shaved where it matters most. Make your dad proud this year and get him and yourself the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0 and the refined cologne. And listen, you're going to love it. The brand new Lawnmower 4.0 refined cologne is perfect for you and your dad. And listen, it's going to complete your grooming game. So get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Now, Matt, apparently dad stinks or bad stinks. And when you get older, you got to rock some cologne. And the refined cologne is a perfect add to your collection. Now, Matt, let you in on a little bit of a secret. I'm a cologne guy. Listen, I've never been an Axe guy. You got to get something that's nice and subtle.
Nothing too strong.
Something that when you get close, you just notice it a little bit, but you're not going to get kicked out of a public building because, you, listen, no sense or good sense, as they always say. So with the refined cologne, it's a subtle little scent. I've rocked it for a number of months now since we've been partnered with Manscaped, and I do really like it, especially compared to what I used to use in the past. Now, they have just released the 4.0, and we had said for, what, a couple of weeks, it's lost in the mail. It'll get here. Today, it showed up. Can you elaborate on that?
I was really excited. So, again, to bring you guys behind the scenes a little bit.
And we got to say, too, you got your own. We're not sure.
No, we're not sure. To bring you into the Fight Night Nation, I should say. I was at home, getting ready, doing some research for the fights like I normally do. My roommate, hey, going to Walmart, you need anything? Nah, I'm good. Goes outside. Then all of a sudden, I get a tap on my shoulder. What is it? Matt, you've got mail. Could it really be finally the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0? And here's the thing. Listen, we've been using the 3.0 for quite a while now. And I know we joke and we go on about how great they are, but we really do use these products and they're great. And we joke about just how much better could they make it than the 3.0. But the first thing that I realized when I first picked it up, and you'll agree with me, is how much lighter this new equipment is. The last one kind of feels like an old paperweight compared to this new machine, and it kind of looks like it belongs in a Tesla spaceship now all of a sudden with the new carrying case. I really can't say enough good things about the new Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0.
I mean, Manscaped, they're the global leaders in below-the-waist grooming. They just dropped their Lawnmower 4.0, and I hope you're excited for this as I am, because it's really legit. I mean, listen, it's got the fourth generation 4000K LED light. Listen, again, we're big shower shavers, sometimes in the dark, sometimes you want to go in a different room, who knows what you're doing with it, but if you and your dad travel a lot, if so, then the 4.0, it's also the perfect trimmer because they have a multifunction on-off switch that can engage the travel lock, and I've been there before, again, I've talked about it, with the discount trimmer. Bet you can't do that with the discount trimmer. Did I just pop the top off? Yes. Why? So you can clean the inside. It's got a ceramic safe edge on there. But you really get these things gunked up if you use them quite a bit, if you've got a bad ball hair situation. The other thing with the travel lock is the fact that you don't want this running in your luggage. And again, with the cheaper trimmers that you have the, what, double A's in? Mine actually did have double A's. Like, it was honking. But you throw it in there, and either you get to your destination, it was on, or the batteries are dead, and then, holy smokes, where am I going to go to get batteries in the strange city that I'm in? So the nice thing about it is you get a great carrying case if you do order a perfect package, which we talked about it before with the shed. But it's got an even slicker charging, like, it's pretty sleek.
Spaceship.
You also get the adjustable grooming guards as well. So maybe you're Rico Suave and you want to look great for the date. That's how you're going to do it. So make sure you check them out. They also have their fine cologne. Like I said, it's the same signature scent that Manscaped formulas have. It's a perfect complement to the collection. And listen, if your old man is smelling a little funky, this cologne is a surefire way to change that and make him the talk of summer. Man of the house deserves to smell like a king. So whether it's a gift for you or your dad or the men in your life, choose Manscaped. Get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with promo code FNP. Don't forget that you came from your dad's balls. This year, show your original home. They wrote that. I didn't write that. Show your original home some love with Manscaped, Matt. As we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time fight at heavyweight in our co-main event this weekend. Matt, really looking forward to it. We have the former main eventer, I can say that, in Walt Harris, the big ticket, taking on Marcin Tybor. And while I don't think that's a great nickname, I do think Marcin Tybor is one of the toughest outs in this division because he holds the one key that a lot of men just can't figure out. This guy will lay, He will pray. He will wrestle you. And when he gets on top, he is a big problem. Just ask former All-Pro Greg Hardy his last time out. For Tabora, it's pretty well the same game plan every time out. Yeah, he adds a little wrinkle here, adds a little wrinkle there in terms of his striking. But his bread and butter certainly his takedown abilities. And he's taking on one of the biggest first-round power threats in this division in Walt Harris, who, after that first round, is 2-6-1 in his career. And again, the one... it was a fight. It happened. And if you look at his overall body of work, he has no contest that ultimately would have been a win. A little bit of a failed drug test against Andrei Arlovsky. If you look at it in terms of a draw, I mean, a long time ago. So if you do look at it, it is tricky that way. But again, the losses, Jared Rosholt, Nikita Krylov, Soa Pileli, Shamil Abdurakhimov, Fabrizio Verdum on short notice, Mark Godbeer, illegal kick. Alistair Overeem and Alexander Volkov his last two times out. So for Harris, really tough level of competition that way. The wins, Olenek, Spivak, you got to think that Spivak win holds a little bit of water going into this one.
And you would have to assume that Walt Harris must have a little bit of confidence coming into this matchup. Because like you had mentioned, the two opponents on his record that most similarly match up with Marcin Tybura, I would say are Alexei Olenek and Sergei Spivak. And yes, I would say Olenek's kind of to the higher end of Marcin Tybura and Spivak's to the lower end of a Marcin Tybura. But they're still in the same category and you know what you're going to get from them. Both those guys, or really all three, can close the distance with strikes. And you know what they're going to try to do. They want to get their hands around you and go for the take. With Marcin Tybura, it's weird. And really, both fighters have their opponent's Achilles heel, if you will. Because Marcin Tybura, he can eat big power shots and then get takedowns. And for Walt Harris, he can sometimes defend takedowns and land big power shots to his opponents before they get more takedowns. It's really one of those fights that just comes down to, can Walt Harris knock out Marcin Tybura before Marcin Tybura can get a takedown on Walt Harris? And it's weird because Marcin Tybura has found himself in similar fights like this. And it just feels like the power threat just increases ever so slightly every single time out. Like, Greg Hardy, what's he good at? Well, he's got pretty good power in his hands. He is a bit of a fast starter. He's not really going to be there to knock you out in the second and third round, but you have to worry about his hands in the first round. Sounds a lot like Walt Harris, but I will admit that Walt Harris is a much more refined version of what Greg Hardy brings to the table. Walt Harris, technically, he does throw really nice straight shots, and he does have really good power, but the thing with Walt Harris is he really is the definition of a first-round heavyweight fighter. I look at Walt Harris very similar to how I looked at Shane Carwin. Shane Carwin, probably not a name you thought you were going to hear today. Because Shane Carwin, for the longest time, that was the stat. You heard that, well, Shane Carwin's longest fight's only 2 minutes. And that's great, but it is a bit of a double-sided sword. Because, yeah, it's great, you're going to knock everyone out so fast. But it also means I have no idea how good your cardio is past 120 seconds. And that's not really that long of a time. So, for Walt Harris, I'm just asking myself, do I think he can land that big shot like he did against Alexei Olenek, flying knee into the left straight? I don't think he can, and I really do think that Marcin Tybura has figured out a way to incorporate, yes, he doesn't have the best striking in the world, but he can strike into the clinch, and once he does get fights into the clinch, yeah, they might not always be the most exciting, but like, even look back at the Ben Rothwell fight, Marcin Tybura is not just a guy who's going to wait in the clinch and not do anything with the position. He can have some good ground to pound off with it. He's got really good uppercuts in the clinch too. He makes use of the position. He's not just getting in the position to stall, and that's what I like about Marcin Tybura. As heavyweights go, I would say he's on the higher end for cardio. And if he can just get out of that first round and make this an ugly fight, I really do think Tybura can make this a really ugly performance, but a performance that he needs to get the win over Walt Harris.
Walt Harris, not one of those guys that has the biggest MMA background coming into the sport, and you're going to hear it, athletic, good striker, power threat for sure. For Tybura, the guy's had way more experience, former M1 champ, and then you look at it, like, what, 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago, we would have written him off. He was 1-4 in a 5-fight stretch, losing to Verdum, Lewis, beating Struve, losing to Abdurakhimov, losing to Augusto Sakai. Since then, Spivak, Grecian, Rothwell, Hardy. Now, Grecian was on short notice. He came in up a weight class, but the Rothwell fight, he looked good. The Hardy fight, he looked great. He's supposed to fight Blagoy Ivanov earlier on this year. It fell out due to an Ivanov injury. Now you get Walt Harris. Matt, I have a hard time seeing Walt Harris winning other than, again, by knockout, like a lot of people have said. So we threw this one out there over in the comment section, YouTube community tab. You got to check these out. Top comment, Angelo Kaz saying, Tybura is underrated. Tybura, TKO round 3. YOLO the reindeer. Harris either KOs him earlier, Tybura wrestles his way to a, you hate to say it, somewhat boring decision. Jack Reinhardt saying, man, I would love to see Harris win. I'm a big fan of him. But out of the total votes, we got 1,100 over in the community tab. 68% going with Tybura, 32% with Harris. And if I can give you the odds quickly, Matt, Harris open a plus 130 underdog. He's about a plus 141. Tabor open a minus 150. He's a minus 171.
So just to piggyback off the comment of if Tabor wrestles, it could be a somewhat boring decision. I actually think if Tabor wrestles, that's his best path to get a finish. I don't think Wal Harris has a very good ability to get back up to his feet. And that's really why I'm picking Marcin Tybura. I feel like this is one of those fights where it's one takedown is all Marcin Tybura needs. Because if Wal Harris is struggling to get back up to his feet and he's just eating ground and pound shots, they might not even have to be the hardest shots in the world. Just the accumulation of them might convince the ref to jump in there and stop the fight. I do think Marcin Tybura has that style of ground and pound, where even look at the Greg Hardy fight, it's not like he was Khabibing him into the ground where you're like, oh my goodness, I'm concerned. It was just such an accumulation of volume. And the fact that Tybura is one of those rare heavyweights who, yes, it's ridiculous to say, but he kind of weaponizes his pace. He can out-tire the majority of other heavyweights out there. And a third round against Marcin Tybura is not a place that you want to find yourself, because he does have that suffocating style that really does lend itself well to an extended fight in the heavyweight division. And for all those reasons, I do feel quite confidently picking Marcin Tybura in this fight.
And maybe if you get a Wal Harris situation like when he fought Overeem in that main event where it's the end of the first round, Harris had a big round, maybe you look at the live line. But yeah, I like Tybura in this fight as well for the performance that we've seen lately. But again, you worry about that opening wave, and then after that, it's not, you can't be carefree, but you can kind of let off the gas a little bit, and you don't have to be as worried. So yeah, Matt, both of us going with Poland's Marcin Tybura to bring the win back for the home country. Really looking forward to that fight. But we also have a big one in the main event. Rozenstruik taking on Sky. You're not going to want to miss those. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. It's finally time for our main event of the evening at heavyweight. We have Jairzinho Rozenstruik, Biggie Boy, taking on Augusto Sakai. Matt, really looking forward to this one. As always, one half of your co-hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. The man to my left, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. If you so do so, just do it at your own risk.
Thank you.
Matt's a weird follow. No, I'm just kidding. But we have a great fight coming up this weekend, and two guys that have really made their mark on the heavyweight division in different ways. For Augusto Sakai, you look at it in the five on in, his last fight, he lost Alistair Overeem. And if we want to play MMA math, Rozenstruik finished Overeem. Rozenstruik will win the fight. But it's not that simple, because Augusto Sakai was one of those Bellator throwaways. He had an old-timey fight against Czech Congo that people just don't think about anymore. Came into the UFC and really had a wave of success until, of course, he lost to Overeem. Now, the fight before that, it was a split decision against Blagoy Ivanov. And if Sakai lost a point for grabbing the fence at the very end of the fight, it would have been a totally different result. Before that, he finished Marcin Tybura. He beat Andre Arlovski, knocked out Chase Sherman. And for Biggie Boy, he came in with a wave of success. He finished Arlovski in the 5-on-1. He finished Overeem. He lost to Ngannou in a windmill of punches. Then he went out and he beat Junior Dos Santos, and then ultimately lost to Ciryl Gane in a main event that was about 2.5, almost 3 months ago. And that's the trouble. This is so weird that you're ending up with Rozenstruik, who looked timid and tentative in his fight against Gane, in a main event against an Augusto Sakai that, yeah, he put it on Overeem at different points, but ultimately got finished in a big time slot his last time out. So prove me fights, and this is really a prove me card, so it doesn't trend from the rest of the fights that we have coming up on Saturday, but it is an odd one too.
This is a really weird fight, and for me, every time I look at the two fighters in the main event, I kind of think to myself, what do these fighters do to really deserve that main event? What have they done to deem themselves worthy? Augusto Sakai hasn't really done anything, and neither has Jairzinho Rozenstruik when you really break apart their records. Yes, Jairzinho has that good win in a main event against Alistair Overeem, but even that win has a little bit of controversy attached to it. My issue is, when I look at both these fighters, for them to be considered main event fighters, let's just look at a few main events we have to look forward to on the horizon. Yair Rodriguez versus Max Holloway. That's going to be this beautiful display of striking and these two very well-rounded mixed martial artists. Augusto Sakai is awful off his back and doesn't have very good cardio. And Jairzinho Rozenstruik has terrible output throughout five rounds. Like, these two guys both have these massive holes in their game that I am a little bit concerned about. And they both have, again, you told me to, I guess, say less basketball references, but I haven't made a few in a while, so let me at least say this. Both of these guys remind me of the Clippers, to where they can both feel like they can turn it on and off at different points in the fight, but I don't feel like either guy's skill are at that level yet. For instance, Derek Lewis is a very good MMA fighter. I know the things that he do, they might be silly, and he might not look like the most refined fighter, but he's still a very good MMA fighter, because when I look at what Derek Lewis can do, he can wrestle, he has good cardio, I know that's a weird thing to say, he has good power, and he can throw a wide variety of strikes. And he has decent output. Like, there's more than just one thing I like about his game. The only thing I like about Jairzinho's game is his counter-striking. And I guess if you want to throw a little side attachment onto it, is when he does move forward, he is a good striker. But my problem with Jairzinho is that when I mentioned the Clippers, their ability to turn it on and off when they think it's important to or not, Jairzinho will kind of go from, oh, I'm in counter-striking mode to, oh, I'm the guy moving forward now mode. When he is moving forward, and the Junior Santos fight's the best example, against JDS, he had no respect for the power of JDS at that point anymore. You just kind of tell. He wasn't concerned about walking forward into the power of JDS. And that was weird too, because he was just coming off the knockout loss to Francis. So you would think, okay, if he's going to be tentative in any fight, well, he just got flatlined by probably the scariest man to ever fight in MMA. He's probably going to be a little bit tentative now. But no, because the opponent was a guy who we knew wasn't the most durable, if he was able to land, he'd put him down. You saw, okay, Jairzinho's moving forward. He's putting combinations together. He looks pretty good. But my issue is, then, look at the Ciryl Gane fight. Then he's coming off a fight where, okay, I knocked out JDS. I should have a lot of confidence right now. He looked like a shell of himself. And I know he had kind of different takes in that fight, but Ciryl Gane didn't even look that good in that fight, if we're being honest. Jairzinho just didn't move forward at all. And it was weird because it's not like Gane ever hit Jairzinho with a big enough shot where you were like, wow, Jairzinho's really rocked right now and he got all this confidence from Gane. Gane just kind of stood at range and, like, threw inside leg kicks and jabbed. He did a good job of keeping the fight at range, don't get me wrong. But with a guy with the striking background of Jairzinho Rozenstruik, you would assume that he has a multiple different ways of getting on the inside of bigger fighters.
So for Jairzinho Rozenstruik, you look at it in terms of what are his credentials. I mean, this is a guy that has oodles and oodles of kickboxing fights against varying levels of competition, but you can see it show in bunches in the fights that he has a lot of success. The fight against Junior Albini, his debut, crazy head kick knockout. The fight against Andrei Arlovsky, the fight against JDS. You know how good of a striker is when he unleashes it. Again, against Overeem, I'm going to wait, I'm going to bait, I'm going to throw my counters. And listen, he almost waited for way too long. I mean, Overeem ran away with that fight right up until the dying seconds. Now, against Ciryl Gane, you have to worry about it because you're going to get two different looks, orthodox, southpaw. You're going to have to worry about the takedowns, and Gane would do that. You know, I'm going to get close. I'm going to try and threaten it a little bit. I'm going to pepper you. He just played with his food more or less. And listen, what's more fun? To watch somebody mukbang on the internet, or to watch somebody at a fancy restaurant kind of play around with the escargot?
Yeah, Craig, you're making Ciryl Gane try to look way too good right now.
They're two totally different things. And so in that fight, it just made for not the most enjoyable watch, if we're being completely honest. I mean, listen, we had a recent fight that a lot of people weren't happy about. Michelle Waterson, Marina Rodriguez. People were down on that. Well, that was a more enjoyable main event than Gane and Rozenstruik, and I don't think that's a stretch to say it. But if you look at it for Augusto Sakai, this is a guy that, by and large, so far, and it's been a big enough sample size in the UFC, doesn't really threaten a lot with the takedown. He's a long-rangey striker. So far in his UFC career, he landed one against Chase Sherman, and that's been pretty much it. And when you look at Augusto Sakai fight, does he come from one of the bigger gyms? No, he comes out of Gil Ribeiro in Brazil, who also fights at that gym. Well, not Anderson Silva. We didn't see who... We didn't see Charles Oliveira come from that gym.
There was a number of fighters.
We saw Rogério Bontorin recently, but, you know, not the biggest names lately, anyway. For Augusto Sakai, though, again, really long-rangey striker, and when he has a lot of success, it's pumping out those shots that he's one of those fighters we like at Fight Night Picks because he's got that pop at the end of those punches,
and he's a good fighter at moving forward, too. He is good at throwing his combinations as he steps forward. He will kind of shift his hits, not to the extent like you had mentioned with Ciryl Gane. Ciryl Gane will do a very dramatic, like, oh, I'm completely southpaw, completely orthodox. Sakai does do a good job of throwing in combination as he does switch stances. He is good at I step forward with both hands. The weird thing about Sakai is he does throw kicks really well offensively, but they're really slow. It's one of those weird techniques where it's like, okay, if the opponent gets out of the way of them, there's nothing to worry about. But if he does land it, much like he did against Marcin Deborah, like, those kicks are very powerful. At the end of the day, though, I just look at Augusto Sakai as a less refined version of Jairzinho Rozenstruik. I think Rozenstruik is a more compact and more powerful version of Sakai. Because at the end of the day, if Sakai's moving forward on Rozenstruik, that's exactly what Jairzinho wants. He wants his opponent to be moving forward so he can try to find the little openings in their game. Because even look back at the Andrei Arlovsky knockout. I know knocking out Arlovsky might not be the most impressive way to beat him, but look at the technique and look at the setup. He knocks him with a beautifully timed check hook on his exit, and that's a really, really hard thing to do against a high-level fighter like Arlovski. If Jairzinho does stick to that counter-striking mindset, I do think Augusto Sakai is going to open himself up enough for the big shot of Jairzinho to land. And listen, this might be a boring fight up until something big does happen, but I do think the person landing the big shot during this fight will be Rosenstreich.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a look at this one at Fight Night Picks over in the YouTube community tab, 1,700 total votes, 71% Rosenstreich. And to go through some of the comments, GM3, I don't know if it's Gerald Mearshare, but main event is all right, but as a whole for fight night, it's stacked from top to bottom. Very good matchups. I like that one. Eric Cortez saying Sakai with more significant strikes and output. I see him winning via decision. Rosenstreich waits too much for his opponent to make a mistake, and he's a counter striker, relies heavily on the one punch knockout. Not enough output to win rounds. And to give another one to friend of the show, Akash Deep, solid fight card. I can't wait. Been dying for some UFC action. I got Jairzinho Rosenstreich in the main event, although I liked Augusto's performance against Overeem, where, again, it was good, and then he got, like, frazzled, and then he got really beat.
And that's the weird thing, too. Augusto's the guy got tired against Overeem, gets taken down, and then gets absolutely dominated on the mat. Now, he took a lot of damage throughout that fight, and it was an accumulation, don't get me wrong, but it was fatigue that really did him in by the end of the fight. Whereas Jairzinho, yes, he got outstruck by Ciryl Gane, but at least he was fresh in that fifth round. Like, Rosenstreich is weird that way. He might not have the highest level of output, but he does carry his power very late into the fight, and that's what I mean. I do see this fight not having a lot going on during the rounds. I could see maybe Sakai wins around like 9 significant strikes to 4, one of those very low output rounds, but I do think eventually in that fourth round, in the fifth round, maybe in the third, who knows, but at some point during the fight, I do think Sakai is going to leave himself open enough for one of those big shots of Rosenstreich to
lose. I mean, Sakai's only loss is a split to Czech Congo, who's going to work the wrestling great avail. And then Overeem, who just kept dumping him down and dumping him down near the end. And that's the thing. You don't have to worry about that against Rosenstreich, unless at training at American Top Team, he's thrown a huge wrinkle into his game at 11-2 early in his MMA career. He's thrown something into it. So if I look at that, I look at the odds, Matt. Sakai open a minus 140 favorite. He's minus 101, slight underdog, near even odds. Rosenstreich open a plus 120 or thereabouts. He's a minus 122 right now. So the odds have shifted. Rosenstreich now the favorite, open the underdog. Again, majority of fans have Rosenstreich to win. This is one of those fights, and I did this last weekend, where I got to go with the experience in MMA of Augusto Sakai in this fight. And I do like him in this because, again, the long-range attacks now, with those hands out there, you leave yourself susceptible to the kick and the counters, like you said, on the breaks. But I do like Sakai in this fight ever so slightly. It is a tricky fight, but I do have Brazil's Sakai in this one.
For me, speed kills, and I really do think the hand speed of Jairzinho Rosenstreich is on another planet than Augusto Sakai's. I do like the output of Sakai, and I do like his ability to string punches together, but my issue is that the punches are moving through mud on their way to you, and I do think a striker like Rosenstreich, is going to be able to eventually time you and land one of those big shots. Again, this fight won't be pretty for Rosenstreich until it is, and I hate using that term, but he is one of those fighters who he's going to catch fire at a weird time throughout a fight. He might be down 2 rounds, he might be down 3 rounds, but I do think eventually he will land that one big shot.
Can't wait to see it, Matt. I've got Sakai, you've got Rosenstreich. We have a huge weekend of MMA ahead, so make sure you tune in to Question Mark Kicks. That's 2 hours before the prelims. I cannot stress that enough because my DMs get flooded and I repeat myself all week. So find it there. You can find us at Fight Night Picks over on Instagram. If you want to know when Question Mark Kick starts, you can find me at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. Should be a great week of fights. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have this weekend and your possible fight of the night. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it.